We'll start out with House File 2799.
This goes to the floor, right?
We don't have a quorum yet, so.
It's in the floor.
Oh, we have a quorum. We'll officially call the meeting to order. Representative Sertich moves the minutes of Tuesday, March 9th, 2004. Any additions or corrections? Hearing all, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay. Representative Gunther, welcome to your committee. If you could please present your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move House File 2799 to pass and be sent on to Jobs and Economic Development and Housing Finance Committee. And with that, Mr. Chairman, this is a dislocated workers program. We've redefined a few things, and we pulled the bill from this committee yesterday because we didn't have consensus that we do today. So with that, I would like to have Commissioner Kramer describe the bill for you.
Welcome to the committee, sir. You please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, I'm Matt Kramer, the Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Mr. Chair, I'll understand you've got a very full schedule. I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. I've prepared a short PowerPoint presentation that you'll have in front of you. The new bill is being put in front of you as we speak. Very quickly, to give you a background on the Dislocated Worker Program, this program began in the federal side of the House back in 1984. There were some adjustments made in 1990. And at that point, the state, under then-Governor Rudy Perpich, developed a state dislocated worker program to complement the federal one. It's important to note that this program is not funded through the general fund, but is funded through a special tax placed on the employers of the state of Minnesota. The current program, as with many programs that were developed, in this case some 15 years ago or 14 years ago, has had some challenges in it, and these are very straightforward. Today there is a distinction between layoffs, what we call mass layoffs, people laid off in groups of 50 and more, versus layoffs of 49 or less. And that distinction is such that the training qualifications that a person may qualify for, the training that an individual may qualify for in a dislocated worker program, is different if you're laid off in a 50 or above versus 49 or below. And in a fundamental issue of fairness, we believe they should be the same. The second bullet speaks to that. In mass layoffs today, there is a presumption that all are eligible for training, whereas in the case of smaller layoffs, 49 and below, you have to prove that you need training. And that results in just some inequities in the system. One of the concerns that we have in the department, and when we go back to then-Governor Perpich's original legislation, is there was to be a very strong tie between unemployment insurance and the dislocated worker program. Because when somebody files for unemployment insurance, we're able, through statistical data, to help predict whether that person is likely to exhaust their unemployment benefits. That is, depending on the types of jobs they've been in, any number of factors. And we can use the dislocated worker program to help target those individuals, give them the training they need to get back into the workforce as soon as possible so that they would be less likely to exhaust unemployment insurance benefits. And then finally, the way the funding is distributed today is not using the UI data. And I have a chart on that that I think will help you. And we can break the UI data down by regions of the state. Remember, when somebody files for unemployment insurance, we were also asking them how they came to be unemployed. So when somebody is laid off, that is a statistical point of reference that we have. This is an important chart for us because today the legislation in the current dislocated worker program limits the funding to essentially a 50-50 split between those who are laid off as a result of mass layoffs and those who are laid off as a result of 49 and below. The statistics have been very straightforward, and on an average basis for approximately the last 10 years, 84% of all people filing unemployment insurance are unemployed as a result of a layoff of 49 individuals or less. Only approximately 15, 16, 20%, depending on the year, are layoffs as a result of 50 or above. Obviously, it varies with the economic times, but what this really demonstrates is we've got a huge portion of people who are potential candidates for the dislocated worker program, and yet the funding today is capped at 50-50 on both sides. What we're going to do in this bill is we're going to change that slightly and give the board the authority to walk through on a quarter-by-quarter basis, allocating the remaining funds to adjust for where the layoffs are coming from, whether they're more mass layoffs or whether they're more day-to-day individuals. The recommendations are very straightforward. The first one would be to modify the eligibility for the program so that whether you're laid off as a result of one person being laid off in a company or whether it's a layoff of 300, ultimately the eligibility is the same. Today, the statute says that no more than 50% of the dislocated worker fund can be allocated to what is called formula funding, and that is distributed across the state to the workforce service areas, run through the workforce centers that many of you are familiar with. That funding we would change to say no less than 50%. And so at the end of each year, historically, the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Board that distributes and runs this program historically has always reached 50%, but it's been towards the end of the year. What we would suggest is let's reach that threshold at the beginning of the year and then give the board the capacity or the capability on a quarter-by-quarter basis as the board meets to make a decision on the remaining funds as to where the money should go, recognizing that we still have an obligation to fund what is called program layoffs, and these are the layoffs of 50 and above. We're always going to retain funds to ensure that when there is a mass layoff, we're able to respond to that. The program today has a number of different accountability measures. They're slightly different between workforce service areas and program providers. We'd like to make sure that all the performance measures are the same for all participants. As part of that, we want to generate performance outcomes for all providers, the individual providers as well as the workforce service areas, so that when an individual enters the dislocated worker program, if they have a choice as to which provider they would like to go with, they understand what the potential outcomes might be. We want to look at long-term training because as I look through the program today, I'm not going to suggest that there's been some abuses, but it is written in such a way that it's rather loose. And we would like to tighten that to say that when the state, through the dislocated worker program, commits to long-term training, generally speaking, that's a credential program. Someone is getting a degree, an associate degree, a particular type of certification, let it be tied very rigorously to industry data. And so if somebody, for instance, is training in a particular field of auto mechanics, that through our Labor Market Information Office, through the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics, and other sources, we're able to say that is indeed a field that if you're going to be in training for 18 months, 24 months, the demand will be there at that point. And then finally, on a quarter-by-quarter basis for the program at the board level, use the UI data and a variety of other data sources. We had some very good suggestions yesterday that you'll see in the bill in front of you as to how the board reaches that decision to say, where should the money be allocated based on trends of unemployment, trends in industry, industries that may be at risk due to macro factors at the worldwide level, for instance, let's say a massive iron ore discovery in Brazil that may put in impact the Iron Range up north, or agricultural in Brazil, as you've seen recently, and the impact that may have in southwestern Minnesota. What is the bill not going to change? Well, first of all, the state maintains a rapid response team today that at any layoff of 50 or above, we respond. We help the organization or the company and the individuals get organized for how they will respond to helping those individuals reach training. That will continue. We're not going to change the threshold for mass layoffs. You may be familiar, the Governor's Workforce Development Council, at your request, did study this program, and presented, already has presented several times, and they've indicated a willingness to move or a desire to move that mass threshold layoff up to 200. We would like to retain it at 50 today. There's some good strong reasons, primarily in terms of customer service for the individuals laid off, that 50 still makes sense. We want to continue to stress that the board will have a responsibility, a very strong one, to ensure that there's always an adequate reserve for mass layoffs, because mass layoffs, by definition, we can't predict. Sometimes you can on an industry basis. For example, my anecdote about iron ore discovery in another part of the world that may put our industry at risk. But in general, mass layoffs happen, as with the terrorist activities of September 11th, unplanned, and we have an obligation to make sure that the fund retains a sufficient reserve. So it's never going to be managed down to zero, that is, all funds distributed to formula. Finally, we're going to continue to have a competitive nature for services. The WSA, some of them contract exclusively with program providers to provide dislocated worker program services. Others provide it through their own employees. We think that the nature of the program is that Minnesota has a strong history of providing competition for who serves dislocated workers, and ultimately that's good for the consumer. That will remain. And then finally, we're doing nothing to stop WSAs that do choose to contract with service providers. In both Minneapolis, Hennepin County, and Ramsey County, a significant percentage of their work is actually contracted with the service providers who are independently qualified by the board. So in those cases, they don't retain their own employees. We're going to allow that to continue to happen. Again, it's good for our consumers. Mr. Chair, that's a very brief overview of the bill. I think that it's a very good one in terms of, over time, any bill has a tendency to reflect a point of economic time. This bill is approximately, or this statute is approximately 14, 15 years old. The changes we're making are actually quite modest. I'm happy to say that, as Representative Gunther noted, we would have testified yesterday. We sat down with our major stakeholders. I'm confident, and in fact, I would ask them to confirm that if you wish. We're in agreement on this now.
Thank you. Do we, Representative Gunther, do you want to move your amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like so we can work off the amended bill?
I would, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move AO4-1073.
Okay. Representative Gunther moves to amend House File 2799 with the AO4-1073 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now, did you have anyone else you wanted to testify on behalf of the bill?
Not unless it's desired by someone who would like to have somebody come up and testify.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify against the bill? Sounds like everything's been worked out pretty much. Questions for any members? Representative Rukavina and then Mallory. Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Gunther and members, and I wish Representative Clark were here because I recall she put in a lot of time on this bill. I believe Representative Lewis was the chief author back in 1990 when we signed this. Basically, you know, Commissioner, you're right, it's 14 years old, and changes have to be made, but this fund has been attempted to be changed every single year. I've been here 18 years. Karen's the only one on this committee longer than me, so let me tell you, because you know, I asked some information about this fund when there was a press release on, and a news story up north in early January on how successful this program was. And Commissioner, he's extremely successful in my district. But the history of this, folks, is this. Passed a law in 1990. By the time it got implemented, Governor Carlson was elected governor. And the first thing he did to this fund was he transferred $1.7 million on it into the general fund. And every year after that, that he was governor, we transferred money out of this fund. It was a permanent, temporary program at first in exchange for the Democrat-controlled House and Senate agreeing to this. We agreed to make it. We wanted to make it a permanent fund. Along came Governor Ventura. I remember, and you folks took over control. Mr. Chair, you became the chair of a new committee. It used to be called Labor Management Committee, and you became the chair of the Commerce Committee. You took absorbed what used to be the Labor Management Committee's duties, so we came in front of this committee. They proposed a huge transfer out of this fund in Governor Ventura's first year. Representative Gunther, I don't know, you weren't the chair then of that committee, Representative McElroy was. And Governor Pawlenty, then the majority leader, and Dan McElroy proposed taking $29 million out of this fund because the economy was so great and we were never going to have mass layoffs again in this, in the world, much less in the United States or Minnesota. I can remember harping about that. That wasn't a good idea. I come from an area where there's always going to be mass layoffs. It's the history of our area. So instead, the $29 million, I believe, along with that, Representative McElroy proposed to cut the tax from the 0.10%.
That's my bill.
Was that yours?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Representative Sikora.
And stop cheating.
Yes. Raise it, or lower it from 0.10 to 0.02.
Okay, 0.07.
No, 0.02 was her bill.
Is this what alcohol?
0.02. I researched all this. This time, now that Majority Leader Pawlenty is governor, who used to accuse me of always fudging my facts. I'm right. I got 100.
To that point.
I'm going to see my kid this afternoon, Representative Sikora, I have the floor.
To that point.
And I'm going to give him some money because he's going on spring break, so I actually have money.
Oh,
I got $400 right here that says I'm right. You want to take the bet?
Representative Sikora.
It was 07 in my bill. It
went to 0.02.
It went to conference committee. And a whole bunch of junk happened to it in conference committee, and I can't tell you. Because that was no longer my bill. It was
no.
General bill.
When the bill came out of the House, Representative Dan McElroy, who is now the governor's chief of staff and one of the brightest minds in Minnesota, I read all the time in the paper, had a $29 million cut, and the bill left here, Representative Sikora, at 0.02%. Okay. House Journal, page 2303, April 15th, you owe me $400.
I'm glad she didn't accept. But
no. Go back to
that point.
My original bill, at least closer to 07%.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sikora, I don't deny that. I'm telling you what happened when the bill left the House of Representatives.
Representative Rocavino, looks like we got another taker here.
They're in the conference committee.
We'll say 0.07. You say 0.02, I say 0.07. You might have a typo, you might want to think about it.
No, it's 0.02, because let me finish the story, Representative.
Okay, let's let Representative finish the story.
They trained the program, they cut the assessment, it was reduced from 0.02 back to 0.07 in conference committee. And you agreed to it, and that's true. And the whole time, though, what happened now, it went to conference committee in 2001. It went back to 0.07. They agreed to the $29 million, but I believe they got their way on raising it back to 0.07. Then in 2002, members, we have, by this time, over $60 million has been taken out of this fund cumulatively.
Who did that?
Since 1990. Okay. And we had a $30 million that we had to put back into the fund because of what happened on September 11th and because of our economy. In the 2002 session, Governor Pawlenty signed a temporary tax increase, which I thought we didn't raise taxes, but the tax went back from 0.07 to 0.10. And now, Commissioner, you have the authority to raise that. And you just said that this is a special tax passed on to Minnesota employees. But the history of this fund is it's always been under attack, and it's a very necessary fund. And I'm worried, and I know this bill is attempting to try to help everyone, but I guess my question after giving you the history and that is this, Commissioner. How many people have we not been able to service because of current law? And now how many more do you predict we will be able to when we go into what you want us to change it to? And will you, with the authority you have to keep bumping that tax up, be able to keep up to the demands that we are going to service more people?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rucavina. Obviously, I can't tell you how many people we would have served because people that don't show up, I can't count. But I can tell you that the changes in this program, particularly establishing good eligibility, making it equal between both programs, concentrating on training that is very productive, because our own numbers show that when somebody participates in the dislocated worker program, they recover a higher percentage of their wage rate than those that simply go through unemployment insurance. So this is a strong, solid program for people in Minnesota. I am confident that with the money we have available and giving the board the ability to distribute the funds between formula and program, we will ultimately serve a greater number of people than we are today with better outcomes. I can't predict, and I would hazard to predict the future in terms of the unemployment rate, what happens in the economy.
Representative Gunther, to that
point. Yeah, to that point, Representative Wilkerman, one of the problems we have and things that we've been trying to correct, and like many things that we do here, we fine-tune things, and we always ran short of money in either mass layoffs like we had the last couple of years or small layoffs like we have in previous years. And one workforce-centered district will have too much money and another won't have enough. And now what we're doing is we're trying to get it so we have a check and balance so those people that need the training will get the training at least to the extent of dollars that we have. Now, we have put in place, Representative Sertich and I worked very hard at it, a system where in times of good times, like back in Carlson's time when we had too much money and it was being raided, it'll go down to 0.07. under existing bill. Right now it's at 0.1. The commissioner under Representative Sertich's and my proposal allows it to go to 0.12. So we are very focused on providing the training because it's such a good program. We look at the results of this program, it's phenomenal. So when you look at it from that aspect, this bill helps that, it doesn't hurt it.
Representative
Gunther, I agree with you. This is a great program. I had defended in 2001 in this committee. When, if I recall correctly, in 2001, the program was abolished. The House bill, it left the House. There was no dislocated worker program. Representative McElroy agreed with Ventura. They abolished the program. And our February forecast that year was not a good forecast. Times weren't good. We totally eliminated the program. Bob, you don't have to tell me about how good this program is. Let me give you folks some numbers. You know, 1,370 people got laid off at LTV, and 950 or so, I'm going by memory. I could be fudging numbers on this one, but I'm pretty close.
Not you.
950 people or so actually applied. The other ones took retirement or whatever. Out of the 950, 780, I think it was close to 800, graduated from the program, and 80% of those stayed up on the Iron Range, which is phenomenal because there really aren't that many jobs. But they went back and they got trained in electrical, you know, as electricians, nurses, RNs, LPNs, guys my age getting LPN and RN licenses, stonemasons and construction, carpentry training. It was great because the other mass layoffs we had in the 80s, people just left, and they never, ever came back. And it's a great program. That's why it concerns me that when we change it, it might have a negative impact. And I just want to be reassured by you, Representative Gunther, that there's the leeway in here to cover a mass layoff like that. If it happens, and that there's going to be money there to cover it. And I've been a proponent all my life of helping working people, and you know that. I want those 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 person layoffs and businesses to be able to be retrained. But, you know, in the past, the money has been there for the large layoffs.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rocavina, I totally agree with you, and I remember fighting very hard to make sure your people stayed up north. Not that I didn't want to come down south.
Oh, be there, Mr.
Yes.
Chairman.
You know? But like you, the largest export we have in my district are educated youth. And it's very important that we keep our population where they feel comfortable and feel at home. And I worked very hard to make sure you had an extension on unemployment for LTV. Then we got the Trade Adjustment Act to give you another extension. We really worked very hard in making sure that the result that you sought was made there, and I will continue to work hard for that same result other places.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Rocavina,
I know you will, Representative, but the fact of the matter is, this fund is constantly under attack, and in fact, in 2001, it was totally eliminated by the House Republicans. And the conference committee saved that. But that's the past, and now the future. What I'm worried about is the money flowing in to be able to handle everything you want to do.
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Rucavina, a point of reference on this program, because of the legislation today that limits no more than 50% going to formula, even in the last couple of years where we've had significant mass layoffs in the state, we haven't used up all the money. And so we have a carry forward from year to year that for the last couple of years has averaged between $6 and $7 million a year. What I would suggest is the board has a responsibility, and it will per this new proposed bill, to make sure that there's always a fund available for the proverbial, you know, the sky falls. But at the same time, I think we can do a better job of managing that down from 6 or 7 to maybe 1 or 2 or 3 and put more of those dollars in the hands of people across the state who need training.
One more question.
Representative Rucavina.
Representative Gunther, Commissioner wants to answer. You know, on your amendment on page 5, one of the issues we had with the LGP layoffs was some of your staff, Commissioner, saying that the training programs they wanted to go into weren't reasonable and wouldn't provide a good livable job afterwards. And you actually gave me a lot of help on this. And you remember, some people were getting approved for exactly the same program, and others in your department were refusing to approve. Mm-hmm. So this language here is a little concerning to me, and you know, I don't know what to propose even here, Representative Gunther, but...
were you looking at line 28?
Line 32. Yeah. Training shall only be provided for occupations or industries with reasonable expectations of job ability. Because that type of argument was used to not allowing Commissioner, you remember, I called you personally on it. So now you're putting that right in statute, and given some of the problems I've had with that particular issue at the for this displaced workers money, it's concerning. So Commissioner, maybe you want to address that, or Representative Gunther?
Commissioner, Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Ruth Davina. I may have a different version than you do, but I'm looking at the end of the section where it says, training shall only be provided for occupation or industries with reasonable expectations of job availability based on the service provider's thorough assessment of labor, local labor market information. And then it goes on to say where the individual currently resides or is willing to locate or relocate. I couldn't agree with you more, and I see this as it is the responsibility of the individual, their service provider, and the department to make sure we're all in agreement as to what the job market looks like. Part of that, I'll agree with you, it's predictive. You're looking into the future saying, you know, there's a couple job openings now, but IT looks hot or something like that. I think the department has a responsibility to put out better policy guidance to our service providers and indeed our staff as to what constitutes reasonable, and there needs to be a little bit of a fudge factor in there.
So, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, you're saying there will be some flexibility maybe in...
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative, absolutely. There has to be some flexibility in this program as a whole because you're talking about individuals. And, you know, as you said, an individual your age might want to be trained as a nurse. Another one might want to be an auto mechanic, and we need to be flexible and responsive to both.
I've got Representative...
I need a nurse, Commissioner.
I have Representative Mullery on the list.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. You've changed in the last minute. Representative Gunther, is Gene Dunn in favor of this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, you have to come down here and answer that.
You want to nod or you want to come down? Okay.
She's in favor of it?
She's in favor of it.
So we have to vote against it then? Or?
No, that's up to you. If she's in favor, I'll vote for it, but you can do what you choose.
Any further questions? Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to go back to the language that Representative Rukavina was talking about on page 6. At the top of that page, it looks like we're adding there that the skills that they're being trained for, or the dislocated workers whose skills are obsolete. So is this saying that they will only be trained if their skills are obsolete? Obsolete is pretty strong. Is that correct then? Because that's not in current law. You're adding that. So only dislocated workers whose skills are obsolete will get training. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, that's for non-transferable skills into a new job. That's what they mean by obsolete skills. I don't think any skill is ever obsolete. However, a lot of skills are no longer applicable. Come on, help me out.
Applicable.
To
you're a teacher.
Well, you're a teacher. I was looking for you. I have a hard time. I wouldn't know if you spelled it right or not. But it's jobs that are no longer in the mainstream. Jobs that... job skills that we are no longer needing. We certainly don't want to train people for jobs that are no longer there.
Well, I understand that, Mr. Chair and Representative Gunther. It's just that seems that new language seems so restrictive on who will get training and who won't. Compared to what we have in current law.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in fact, that is the intent, because by looking at the training eligibility, we will be able to focus the dollars for those who need them the most. The current law allows layoffs of 50 or above. Remember, I said, by definition today, everyone qualifies for training. Now, there is an order of priority, those who need it the most versus those who need it less. But we have situations today where people with very good, solid skills, because of a mass layoff situation, qualify for additional training when, in fact, the skills that they have are more than adequate to work in the job market today. I think this responds in part to Representative Rukavina's concern that we have a limited amount of dollars, and we need to focus on those who will benefit the most from the program.
But
absurd one.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, we have a limited amount of dollars because we raided that fund and put it in the general fund last year. That's why we have a limited amount of dollars. So I just think that right now we should be doing everything we can to get people back to work. And maybe their skills aren't obsolete right now, but maybe the state agencies are shipping their jobs overseas, and so computer technicians that we're training now in colleges and so forth will not have jobs when they get out. So you may say, okay, well, we'll train them because we won't train them because their skills aren't obsolete, but their skills are becoming obsolete, or their occupation is becoming obsolete. It just looks like such restrictive language compared to what we would do now. And I just think with the high unemployment rate we have in the state, and with the sustaining job loss and sustaining unemployment that we have, we shouldn't be making this program more restrictive than it already is. And would you remind me what we took out of this program last year to help balance the budget that went into the general fund instead of into...
Mr. Chair, Representative, zero last year.
Zero, okay. Mr. Chair, when did we? The year before last?
Ventura administration, we took some. Early Ventura administration.
Okay, so we haven't taken any out in the last 2 years?
We've been short of money since then.
How much did we, Mr. Chair, how much did we take out? I went in the Ventura administration. What dollar figure?
I don't know, but we'll ask the commissioner.
I think you said $29 million, didn't you?
Yeah. Mr. Chair,
way too much.
$29 million in 1999.
I think $30 million was transferred
in 2000 in two different bills.
Okay.
So $59 million.
That was a good one. Anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, yes. So we're short in the fund, so what you're saying is we can't serve all the people who we currently would be serving under the current law or could be serving because we're short of money. Is that what you're saying, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, one of the issues that we have today is remember that the current statute limits us to distribution of formula funds of no more than 50%.
Right.
And so I hate to be facetious, but if one is fortunate enough to be laid off at the beginning of a year, they're in a better chance of receiving training than towards the end of the year where they may be put on a waiting list.
Mm-hmm.
The change that we're proposing is to allow the board to better manage those funds to allocate when demand is seen more to formula so that individuals who today are on a waiting list might be able to be served right away.
And Mr. Chair, Commissioner, that's a noble goal, and I appreciate that. I'm just concerned about the fact that you're making it so restrictive on who can get retrained, and that seems to me like you're putting that in statute so that the board doesn't even have a chance to discuss that. Under current law, I would assume they would have some options in that area about who was going to be trained based on the amount of funds you had to last you. That would be a management issue. That would be a department or a board management issue, but now we're putting it in statute, so there's no way that, a lot of people, I think, would be eliminated from being able to be served by this program with this language. You would just say to them, well, the law prohibits it, so we can't do you or this industry or whatever.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the point that you're laying out is one of when do we train somebody versus when do we don't, and it depends on a variety of factors. It depends on their work history. It depends on the skills that they have at a point in time. I don't think any of us are qualified to say that if IT outsourcing, for example, were to accelerate, if somebody is an IT worker today and is laid off, should we train them in another skill because their skill might become obsolete in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years? We will focus this fund on those individuals who their skills are obsolete. That is, they have no transferable skills, and they're going to have a very difficult time finding a comparable wage rate to what they're being paid right now versus those who have a skill today. It is not obsolete. It may be tempered to some degree by industry trends or otherwise, but they are still capable of finding a job within their industry at a wage rate that's comparable.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I understand all that, but I'm just saying, why do you have to have this in law? Why do you have to be this restrictive in law on who you're going to? It seems to me like those are very fluid issues, and why would we want to put it in law to restrict access to this program? If you can see that, I just think we should leave more of those.
I think they the same questions was answered.
Yeah, I don't think so, but thank you, Mr. Chair. But I have another question then.
Okay, not a new question.
No, it's, pardon?
This is a new question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, okay. It's a new question because I'm not going to get the answer to my first one. Yes, okay, it's a new question. Maybe you know this, Commissioner. I know your agency does millions of dollars in consultant contracts, and I'm wondering if any of that goes to companies that do outsourcing overseas.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can answer that 100%. The answer is no. None of the dollars that we use for consultants are paid in any way, shape, or form to firms that are overseas.
That, Mr. Chair, that are American firms or Minnesota firms that have jobs overseas?
If they are, I am totally unaware with them. We make a very strong, conscientious effort on the part of my own personal preference and that of the contracting folks that we have to do business with firms that are either in Minnesota as preference one or those that at a very minimum are U.S.-based.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And Representative Rukavina.
Commissioner, you know, I heard a rumor, and you know how rumors are around here. But reassure me on this one. Brouhaha that arose recently about the company that had the bid with Human Services, I believe it was, that then laid off workers, I think they were here in Minnesota, and hired people in India. I heard that they then applied to train those workers through a dislocated worker program. You know if that's true or just a rumor?
Commissioner.
But I did hear that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, this is the first I've heard of it. So if it's a rumor, it's a rumor. I'd be happy to check into it.
Mr. Chair, if that happens, you know, I would hope we could tax those type of people at about 0.5 instead of 0.12 or whatever. But I do have one final question. Commissioner, you are really one of the nicest guys I've ever met, especially in a blank state industry. And I didn't even put it in writing. I had Weaver made me write a job evaluation to the commissioner, and I said, "You're one fine guy, you are." So I'm not worried about you having the power that seems to be transferred from the board to the commissioner in this amendment, but. You know, I might be worried about commissioners in the future, and I wonder why, Representative Gunter, that you want to take presently on the performance standards in the amendment on page 6, all of the what used to be the board making decisions and then conferring with the commissioner to now the commissioner basically adding all the authority and conferring with the board.
Representative Gunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my understanding that we're depoliticizing this and we're giving those choices to the Job Skills Partnership Board. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Yeah, in fact, I apologize, it's page 7 for me, section C, the commissioner in consultation with the board. So that in all aspects, when performance measures are set or whatever direction is set, it's always in consultation with the board. Our intent, and I know it was written up in your summary as making it sound like the commissioner is taking on all kinds of responsibilities, the intent was to make sure that the reporting is very clear, that when somebody reports on the progress of the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Board, it is the commissioner reporting on the performance standards for outcomes and dislocated worker. That's more of a broad agency initiative to normalize all of our performance measures across all programs.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
The old language in the performance standards, the board, in consultation with representatives of local workforce councils, elected officials, etc., and the commissioner later on are the ones kind of setting the standards. And now the new language, starting on line 10, is the commissioner in consultation with the board, etc., etc. So, is there someone from the board member here?
Is anybody from the? Well, come on down.
That was a
good thing. I'm sure you know the routine. Your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Thomas, and I'm with the Jobs Now Coalition. I'm also a member of the Job Skills Partnership Board.
So, Mr. Chair, can
you ask your question?
Are you comfortable with the change in call, it seems to me that the board is now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, I raised this issue myself with the commissioner and actually feel quite comfortable with the commissioner and with what's going on in the department across programs, trying to have some common performance measures and trying to have some consistency. I do believe that the relationship of the board to the department is sufficient, that the board will be consulted. That is actually what happened with this bill as well, that the board did have quite a bit of input into the... So I am comfortable with the way it is right now. I do think that other members of the board have been actively interested in this program and will continue to be, and we need to have that kind of activity with the board.
All right. Mr. Rukavina,
I'm comfortable.
Are you comfortable now?
Sure, too. Like I said, it might not be the same way in the future.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, I do think that it does change the board's role to a certain extent in statute. I think the way that it actually works is that the board does have to trust to a certain extent the department and the department staff to provide information, and the board itself, if we were uncomfortable with something, we would have to take action as a board to do something. I agree that there is a level of discomfort not knowing who future commissioners might be, and it is something that I personally will be paying close attention to as a board member and as somebody who is concerned about this program. And other job training programs in the department. I would also add that when I thought through how to share that responsibility, I think it would be difficult. I have not come up with a way in which it would be clear in statute and almost legally feasible to have the board and the commissioner together entering into contracts and making requirements. So I think it's something that we should pay attention to moving forward.
Hey, members, we have a lot of bills on the agenda today. So as long as Representative Rukavina is now comfortable as well.
Mr. Chair, it's a very reluctant endorsement, but I'm going to talk to Representative.
All right. Okay, I don't have anybody else on the list. So Representative Gunther renews his motion. At House File 2799, as amended, be passed and sent to the Jobs or Committee on the Jobs and Economic Development Finance, where I'm sure it will receive a favorable hearing from the chairman.
Representative Sertich will make sure.
All right. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? No. The motion carries. Thank you, Representative Gunther. The next item on the agenda is what? House File 2487. What are we doing? House File 2274, Representative Bradley. And Representative Huntley as well.
We
don't honor the Bradley. Okay, we got a two for today.
Excuse my region.
I'm with
you. Okay, Representative Bradley, I'll go ahead and move your bill, House File 2274. And can you tell me where this bill needs to go?
This can go to the floor.
I'm sorry, to the floor. Okay, I'll move that House File 2274.
Yeah.
You recommended a pass and sent to the General Register.
And Mr. Chair, if you'd also be willing to move the DE-1 amendment.
I'll
that
do that.
Can
we have it quiet, please? I know we're transitioning from one bill to the next, but if you could, we want to get started with the Bradley and Huntley bills. Okay, we have a, this is a delete everything as well. So I'll go ahead and move the 2274 DE-1 amendment. And we'll move that. This is a office amendment. Did you want to explain this first, or do you want us just to go off and delete everything? Why don't we just
do
that?
If you could adopt the amendment, then we can discuss the bill from there.
Go ahead. This is an author's amendment. So all in favor of the DE-1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Okay, the DE-1 amendment is what we're working off of right now, and Representative Badley, if you want to explain your bill.
Well, we will explain our bill, I think, in the end here. We'd like to have pictures taken of this partnership. There'll be no hugging, but... but to be serious, members, I've been before this committee before on health insurance issues, and this is just another one. And this is probably the toughest market to break. This is the market which is the very small and medium-sized companies, particularly in rural and greater Minnesota, where it's often very difficult for companies to be able to continue to provide affordable products to their employees. We have been working with the employers' associations and other groups along the way. The legislature has, in fact, provided some flexibility, allowed alliances to form, done some things with what's called the Multiple Employee Welfare Association. And what the bill before you today is just some additional modifications.
Excuse me, Representative Badley. If we could have folks maybe take your conversations to the back. We're having some difficulty hearing up here. So I appreciate that. Okay, sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's very helpful. This is a modifications to some of those things that we, in fact, had done before to help those employers. And I think just to give you kind of a flavor, in the Employers Association alone, we're talking about 400-plus employers, 26,000 or so employees, average company size, 150 or so. And so we're talking about a lot of people who have had an interest. And there are certain parts of the states that have been, I think, pioneers in trying to apply these techniques. The way we'll proceed, I would like to offer Representative Huntley an opportunity because he has one specific area in the state that would benefit. And we've combined two bills into one with this delete also, mm-hmm. for saving some time for the committee. And then I think for the actual quick explanation of the bill, we'll turn it over to Ms. Liz Kwan, who can review that. And then there's some other people who would like to make some comment after that. So with that, let me turn it over to Representative Huntley.
Okay, Representative Huntley, welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, we had two bills that were very similar, looking at the same groups of small employers that are trying to get together so they can purchase health care and, in effect, have the same clout in the marketplace as large companies. And we've been tinkering with this for years. These two bills did the same thing, and what the delete all amendment did is basically combine the two bills. And I will say I've learned over the last number of years that if I change the first four letters of my last name from H-U-N-T to B-R-A-D, that I have much more success.
Okay. Did you want some folks to testify? I have three names on the list. Or.
Mr. Chair, if you might have Ms. Kwan sort of quickly explain, I think it's fairly short, but quick explanation of the bill, and then we can testify.
Ms. Kwan, if you could please state your full name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Elizabeth Kwan Burney. I serve as the volunteer executive vice president of Advocates for Marketplace Options for Main Street. It's a nonprofit coalition of employers and healthcare providers working for more options for both. We have been providing technical assistance to the purchasing alliances around the state. If you'd like more information about them, I've got some information with me. Specifically, Breakwater Purchasing Alliance in on the range in northwestern or northeastern Minnesota and Duluth area, and the Employers Association, which is a has a lot of manufacturing members, were both independently working to find a way to do group self-insurance, and they came up. They were using the changes that you had made to the MIWA law a few years ago, and they both came up independently with glitches, and this bill is to fix those little glitches that will keep them from going forward with what they're working on. The first change that's made is it allows, under certain circumstances, the and this is specifically for Breakwater, the Northeastern Purchasing Alliance Group, the number of people to begin the group product to be 1,000 enrollees instead of 1,000 employees. This will allow Breakwater to ramp up. When you're talking about onesies and twosies with businesses, it's really tough to get to that 1,000 employees right away. You can do it if you can also count dependents. I'd like to let you know that the reason we worked for the last year, we worked with the Department of Commerce on this. The reason that I think they were comfortable with that is because of how Breakwater is doing it. They're working with First Plan, which is a subsidiary of Blue Cross Blue Shield. So, and the Department of Commerce will be able to look at everything that's going on, so they'll make sure that there is no inappropriate lack of coverage for any incurred claims. The second thing that it does is it remains silent on the other states and their MIWA laws, which are also a tangle, which, since it's this state that's regulating it, seemed appropriate. The next thing that it does is it, because of new ways that we put specific and aggregate stop-loss insurance together, it says, okay, Commissioner, you cannot not have these guys have stop-loss coverage, and you can't, you have to have it equivalent to what is in the intent of the law. But some of the old regs and the law itself, it's hard to fit within the new spec and ag markets, specific and aggregate insurance. But again, for all of you that are concerned about covering or protection of enrollees, the workers, just know that because the stop loss has to stay on it, and there has to be equivalent on any kind of excess stop loss, the commissioner's flexibility is only goes so far. The next thing that it does is, because the MIWAs, unlike the Taft-Hartleys, and actually these, what is being set up is a lot more like Taft-Hartley. If any of you are familiar with those are collectively bargain groups, union groups that get together like industries, than the MIWAs of old. That's actually the model that we've looked at. But unlike the Taft-Hartleys, the MIWAs will be paying both the MCHA assessment and the premium tax, and therefore we asked to be exempted from the conversion coverage since we are paying into what's going on with the state pools as it is. And then finally, according to the Department of Revenue, it was an oversight. Mr. Pender might be able to add to that if you have a question, but there was a revenue fee on the MIWAs that was not taken out when a few years ago you added a premium tax in, so actually it would be double taxation. So we're repealing the revenue fee, but again, the MIWA will be paying both the premium tax and the MCHA assessment.
Okay, Ms. Quam, thank you very much. So now I've got a list of three names here that I understand are in support of this. Let me just ask, is there anybody in the audience who is in opposition to this bill? Anybody at all? Okay, so I see there's no opposition in the audience, so we'll keep that in mind. We can have the proponents come and speak, but if they understand that there is no opposition, we can move the bill along if they get the hint. So I have a Jim Hooley from Breakwater Purchasing Alliance. Is that right?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. And if you
thank you very much. My name is James Andrew Hool, and I'm from Duluth, Minnesota. Chairman and members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to share our hopes for small employers in northeastern Minnesota concerning health care coverage that can be realized with the passage of this House bill. I've had the privilege for the past 2 years to be chairman of the Northeastern Minnesota Healthcare Purchasing Alliance called Breakwater. Breakwater's mission as a nonprofit organization is to provide a more affordable, accessible, and accountable option for healthcare, especially designed to meet the needs of small businesses, nonprofits, and self-employed people in northeastern Minnesota. Over the past 2 years, Breakwater has explored traditional options available to create a health insurance model to cover employees of small businesses, none of which have worked. The bottom line, the insurance plans do not want to take the financial risk of insuring small employers, especially farmers, loggers, and seasonal workers in the tourist industry, many of which have not had insurance before. As a result, the Breakwater Board last fall that we must take the financial risks ourselves. This option is possible under 62H, joint self-insurance of multiple employers. But in order for this to occur, there must be some language changes in this statute, which are included in the bill before you. I would like to explain the first language change in the bill we are requesting. Under 62H.01, the statute requires these multiple employer plans to have a minimum of 1,000 covered employees. We are requesting the word employees be changed to enrollees. We will count up the potential enrollees, which include employees, spouse, and children from the employer groups that have most expressed an interest in Breakwater, and there are about 1,600, which represents about 500 employees. We are confident that these numbers will grow once our plan is up and running, but we don't want the current language to stop us from basically getting off the ground. Thank you for your attention and for listening to how Breakwater feels. Thank you,
Mr. Houle. Appreciate that. Representative Bradley.
And just to kind of, there are other people, the Employees Association has people here as well, but I think that the committee has heard some pretty compelling things, so we won't need to take a lot of your time. I would also tell you that the Chamber supports this, and the Department of Commerce supports the changes that are being proposed to you. With that, I think we'd turn for any questions. Okay. Ready to move on.
Any questions? Bill? Yeah. Representative Hawes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. A couple of years ago, we worked on the MIWA law and made it a little more viable. And what was interesting is the Commerce Department fought us all the way on the changes. And now they're endorsing the changes to even make it more liberal. And I think as we go forward with this bill, and I have been talking to the author and to some of the people involved in this to try to help it to make it get better, but one of the things we have to be careful of, and I offered this as a suggestion to Representative Bradley earlier today and members, but when we looked at this, we felt 1,000 lives, 5,000 member employees was critical to get the pool to a certain size to make it viable. Because the problem with these pools, if they're too small, they'll fail. And I've set up plans in the 80s, association plans and things like this. If you don't get your numbers, they go down. And so, but by them going to 1,000 enrollees, you're shrinking the size of the pool, and it makes it more dangerous for the pool to survive. So what I suggest, and you can do what you want, but I think what we may want to look at is keep it at 1,000 employees for the 7-county metro area, but to help the outstate people, drop it down to 500 employees participating in the rural areas. That way, I think it fits into the group up in northeastern Minnesota to make their pool viable, but and use that as a kind of a compromise, but still they got to get more numbers than even a couple thousand, because risk pools, you need tens of thousands of people in there, and even at that, I know the Chamber had one and Employer Association had one a number of years ago. They had 30,000 people in, and it still failed because of losses and rates, you know, and claims that came into it, so and then the pool fell apart. So it's real tricky how they do this. The other thing is the solvency issue. You were being asked to waive solvency issues on here. And I've asked this not only of this plan, but in the teachers program, who is going to be the guarantor of this program? Because there has to be money, you know, and I'm surprised the Commerce Department is even looking at allowing the waiver of solvency requirements under a plan, because they're this is critical to make the program work. And then the other thing is, again, we had discussion last night in Commerce Committee in regards to the MSHA situation, and there is no continuation of coverage here after they leave the plan. So there's no conversion coverage, things like that. So right away, people are going to go into MSHA if they can't get insurance. And so that is going to create more stress on the MSHA pool. So, but you know, that's something I work with. And then waiving the I think I heard Ms. Qualm say they're going to pay the MSHA assessment, but not the premium tax?
No.
Okay. So,
thank you.
Okay, well, okay.
Part right. of our so, program of an adjunct duck.
Members, you know, it's a real tricky thing to do, and I'm not opposing what they're trying to do, but I think we got to look at this realistically to see what we can do to make this work. And those are my concerns that I have with the bill, and, you know, I'm willing to work with the group to see what we can do to rectify those. But solvency is a big issue, and I think the lives to make it work has to be worked on.
Hey, we had some questions as
Thank
well,
you,
but Representative Huntley first.
Mr. Chair and members, the Commerce Commissioner or the Commerce Department has looked at this. They've been working with the two groups for a number of years, and it's my understanding that the they're fine with this. They have the commissioner still has the authority to approve or disapprove of any arrangements that are made. They're happy. I think the Commerce Department has an excellent record of looking at solvency issues and doing a good job of that. So I think that in my particular part of the state, they just can't get start out with 1,000 employees in this group. And as I said, the Commerce Department feels that the number we've suggested is adequate.
Okay, we have some questions over here first. Yeah, you.
Yeah, you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I've been called worse.
You got Mahoney's name tag ready to throw you for a loop.
There you go. The last two nights we've heard a lot about the mandates, and is this plan going to be required to participate in the state mandates, or are they going to be exempt? Are they going to be exempt plan? Are they well outside the 30% that we're talking about the last two nights?
Ms. Quam, I think, is going to answer that. Or
Mr. Chair, Representative, under the state law, what they have to do is follow the ERISA guidelines. So it would be what self-insured companies have to follow,
which,
although they still have to pay the state assessments.
They would not be covered from the mandates. Okay.
Okay. Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, and I'm glad to see Mr. Haas, or Representative Haas, gets to be part of our committee today.
What's our pilot program for adjunct
committee
members?
Then maybe Representative Dempsey will let me sit on the local government when Representative Klinsing's mold bill comes up today, too, and that would be just super. I also want to ask whether Employers Association is the only entity affected by this.
No.
Whoever.
No.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Goodwin, this bill applies to anybody that would start one of these MIWA-type organizations. We've talked about two groups that have negotiated this with the Department of Commerce. They would be allowed to do that, but so would anybody else that could assemble, if it's still 1,000 enrollees, anybody else could do it as well.
Okay, Mr. Chair, just to follow up.
Something, Mr. Chair, Representative, excuse me. There, besides these two groups that have been working on it and found out where the problems were, there are two other groups sort of waiting in reserve to see what happens with it. One is in central Minnesota, where we have we have the highest level of working uninsured. That's the Brainerd, Staples, Crosby, Aiken area. They are just waiting to see what happens here, and then they've been looking at it very intensely. We've been working with them. And then the other group is a group of three agriculture cooperatives in south central and southeastern Minnesota. United Farmers Co-op has been leading that.
Okay, thank you. One more question, Mr. Chair.
Good one.
Thank you. I also wanted to ask you, is your organization part of the Employers Association? Are you connected with them in any way?
Mr. Chair, Representative, Employers Association is a sponsor of AMUM. We have other sponsors, too. Yeah.
And, Mr. Chair, how many other sponsors do you have?
Mr. Chair, Representative, several dozen, probably. I can give you a list of them. North Star Physicians would be one. Representative is in the audience for that. That's a provider group in northeastern Minnesota.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any further questions? Seeing none, yes, Representative Rukavina, question. You'll have to ask him. It'll be up to the chair.
Representative Rukavina, if you want to come and speak before my committee, you can do that.
I want to sit on here.
Do you know, do you know something about state departments?
We'll talk about it.
Okay. I will renew my motion then for House File 2274 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? The motion carries. Thank you very much, Chairman Bradley and Representative Huntley.
Thank you.
Okay. That next item will be House File 2704, Representative Osment. Welcome to the Commerce Committee. Are there, where's the bill? Do you have any amendments?
Not that I'm aware of, Mr. Chair.
No amendments, okay. Yeah. Got this, I'll go ahead and move House File 2704 on your behalf. Representative Osment, if you want to explain your bill. Oh, what is this going to be going to? I'm sorry. The destination? Civil law, is it?
Civil law.
Civil law, okay.
Or, judiciary, civil law, I don't know what their name
civil
is.
Civil law, okay, I'm told civil law. So I will move House File 2704, be recommended a pass and sent to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Osment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And Mr. Chair, I might comment that you're just a shadow of your former self there. This chair, Representative Davids, has very kind to give us a hearing on this bill. He's now a co-author on this bill. As you recall, a few years ago we were here talking about providing safer cigarettes with regard to their fire resistance when they are dropped or come in contact with materials that in the rooms or in the living environments where people are at. And we know that that is one of the careless smoking is one of the biggest negative factors that we have with regard to lives lost in the state of Minnesota with regard to fires. And so we were trying to address that issue. Technology is here that we can make cigarettes safer. In fact, when they are then dropped or people stop smoking them, that they actually will self-extinguish. And this is now... We were at one time talking about rules that may get adopted. We now have a state, the state of New York, that has gone forward with this. And we would like to bring this back to your attention and see if this is something that we should be following in the state of Minnesota to try and save lives and or costs to the state of Minnesota. As you know, when not only is property lost in these fire situations, but it's also significant costs on the taxpayers to provide for the fire protection to kind of come to the residence and or the structure and try to put the fire out, and also the workers' compensation costs and so forth that goes along with that when we have injured workers in trying to fight those fires. So if we can prevent the fires, that's really the best way for us to go. Economically, it's the conservative thing to do. Mr. Chair, I have with me some testifiers that would like to introduce themselves and present testimony on this subject.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. My name is Tom Brace. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association. Also with me is the Eden Prairie Fire Chief, who will speak to some specific fires, cigarette-caused fires. Let me give you just a little bit of background. As Representative Osment mentioned, this is not new technology. There are two brands of cigarettes out now that meet this standard. We are not going where no one has gone before. New York, on June 28th, after some exhaustive study, and has crafted some rules that will allow only fire-resistant cigarettes to be sold in New York State. Very quickly, just so the technology is understood, an additive historically has been placed in cigarette tobacco so that when the smoker sets it down in an ashtray, the industry decided they didn't want it to go out. Just keep it burning, and then later on, when the person decides they want to continue to smoke, they light another cigarette. They hadn't planned to relight it. Now, what makes this particularly difficult and tragic, both to the public and the firefighter, is that as that cigarette is dropped or falls out of the ashtray, it smolders and continues to burn, causing ignition, particularly in combustible surfaces like combustible furniture. Now, when we talk about people dying, in Minnesota, about 3% of all fires are cigarette-related fires, smoking fires, but they represent about 40% of all the fire deaths. Minnesota is not unique. It's the same statistic nationwide that while the number of fires caused by cigarettes, there are other more common fires such as heating or cooking, but the result is tragic, and it's the number one leading cause of fire deaths. And I'd like to have you reflect on that for just a moment. 60% of the people perish in fires caused by cigarettes were not the smoker. There's also a disproportionate number of children and seniors that perish in other parts of the house from this fire. So what we are moving toward then, and this has been almost a 20-year effort, is New York has shown the way. This legislation envisions following New York, and even would entertain an extension to learn from New York's experience. But we will adopt the New York rules, and we will make a significant reduction in the number of fire deaths caused by cigarettes in Minnesota, which is the leading cause of fire deaths, not only in Minnesota, but nationwide. Now, to speak about several specific fires and the impact not only on the public, but the fire service, is the Eden Prairie Fire Chief, George Espenson. George?
Thank you. My name for the record is George Espenson. I'm the fire chief from the city of Eden Prairie. And I come here today because last year, in 2003, my city experienced firsthand the havoc that's created by discarded smoking materials improperly. We had three significant fires that were related to discarded smoking materials. The first one was in April. It was an 18-year-old that was smoking on the back deck of his parents' house. It was during a tremendously windy Sunday afternoon. And when he discarded his cigarette, it fell through the cracks of the deck down into the leaves and whatnot below. His house caught on fire. Unbeknownst to him, he went up to take a nap. His neighbors actually saw it when they were backing out of their driveway on the way to go on a shopping trip and noticed not only their neighbor's house on fire, but also their own house. The garage had already ignited from radiant heat. And so in that fire, for which we called nine other fire departments to, there was two houses that were completely destroyed by fire, a little over $1 million worth of damage, and the two families were displaced while their houses were, you know, bulldozed eventually and then rebuilt. The next event was the 18th. It was an apartment building, a discarded cigarette in a flower pot on a second floor deck ignited. That fire was again, eight different fire departments responded to help us battle that blaze. About $350,000 in damage. 30 units were destroyed by either the fire or smoke and water damage, and 75 people were displaced in that event. And then in August, to complete our run of discarded cigarette fires, we had a fire on August 12th. It was again an apartment building. A couple of gentlemen were tossing their cigarette butts out onto their deck onto one of these little coffee cans, and they missed, and it got into the building material on their deck. They monkeyed around with that fire for a little while, called us, told us it was out, but they just wanted us to check it. Upon getting there, we did our investigation and found that the fire had run up the chaseway from the second floor into the third floor, And about the time that we were deploying our assets, fire broke out on the third floor and the second floor, completely engulfing one wing of the building. That fire displaced 50 units, 125 people, $500,000, and also to the point, I guess, specifically, because this was a careless, needless fire. I had three of my firefighters injured, two knee injuries and a skull fracture. The one knee injury person has been through a couple of surgeries. He's still going to rehab 3 days a week, and that fire happened in August. We hope to get him back on June 1st of this year, so that would be about 9 months where we've had somebody on the injured reserve as a result of this tragic event. So in total, last year in Eden Prairie, three significant fires directly related to this, $1.85 million in damage, 206 people displaced for a period of 4 or more months, depending on their specific situation, and I still have one firefighter that's not back to full service yet. So we're very passionate about this in Eden Prairie. I have the support of my city manager, and we don't have a council resolution on this topic, but if you'd like one, I'm sure we can get that for you in the next couple of weeks. So thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you. We have a question. Representative Coles.
I can wait until everybody's done.
Okay.
After everybody's done.
Is there any other testimony, Representative Osment?
From your side for the presentation? Opposition.
Sure. Okay. Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chair, I would just remark that the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, the Minnesota State Fire Department Association, Fire Marshals Association of Minnesota, the Minnesota chapter of the IAAI, and MERAC, all major fire groups in Minnesota are supporting this legislation.
Okay. I'm going to ask one question while you're at the table then, Mr. Rice. In the language, it refers to adopting rules substantively identical to the New York state rules. This isn't statute. This is session law. Is that correct? I guess my first question is this session law as opposed to a statute?
This is coded for statute.
Oh, it is. Okay. I'm just curious about referencing or linking ourselves to another state, their legislative efforts and what they're doing, and who we can't control what they were to do. So what happens if they veer off course? We've passed a law that links up to what they're doing. Are we confident in the outcome of that?
Mr. Chair, if I could, with regard to 299F, which is the statutes that deal with the fire prevention codes and so forth, we reference other codes on a routine basis. Most of them are nationally promulgated, where this one would be just promulgated within the city of or the state of New York. But maybe a former fire marshal, Tom Brace, can address that.
There are about five states that are currently considering this legislation. Canada, we understand, is quite close to adopting a standard. New York clearly has been in front, but has been communicating with other state fire marshals across the country all along in its process. And a number of other state fire marshals in this piece of legislation envisions the Department of Public Safety through its division of state fire marshal to be the rule promulgator. I believe it's pretty well tested, and clearly through their open process in New York, the industry has had a chance to respond with their concerns. There is that time delay, so we'll have the New York experience to follow. Plus, I also in my testimony mentioned if there is an interest to make possibly a six-month extension to give you a year to follow the New York experience. But I believe it, we're dealing with some pretty tested technology here.
Okay. I've still got on the list Coles, Clark, Sikora, and Davids. You can ask your questions now, or you can, and Lanning as well. You can ask your questions now, or did you want to wait till we hear the opposition? I'll start with Clark. Karen? Representative Clark.
Thank you. I think this would be a question
for us. Rosa, could you speak into your microphone, please? We're having difficulty hearing.
I think this would probably be a question for the author. I just can't recall because it's been a while since I had the discussion with the folks who are supporting this. I've always supported this legislation, by the way. But I'm just not remembering that do these cigarettes, are they treated with something, or is it that they're not treated to be to continue to burn? Is that the That's my question.
Representative Clark, there are various technologies that can be used, but the technologies that I'm familiar with are just dealing with the configuration of the paper and make it more difficult for it to burn. They have to use bands down the paper, make little thicker spots so that when the cigarette that's not being puffed on, when the smoldering part hits that, it stifles the oxygen content and the cigarette extinguishes. There may be other technologies.
But, Mr. Chair, Representative and Representative Osmond, that's correct. It's been referred to euphemistically as a speed bump. And there is an additive removed. That is the additive that causes the cigarette to continue to burn after you lay it down in an ashtray or it falls down.
Thank you.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I missed when the bill was when the motion was initially made. Where's this bill going next?
That's going to civil law.
Good. I guess I'll get to see it there. But Mr. Chair, Representative Osmond, do you have a fiscal note on the bill?
No, I do not.
Mr. Chair, I see that we're requiring rulemaking by the department, and I'm just curious as to what the fiscal cost may be. And then, secondly, Mr. Chair, with regard to the rules that need to be substantively identical to the New York State rule, but we're building in a delay in case there's a problem with the New York rules. Well, I think there's a problem in drafting, if nothing else. I mean, if there's a problem with the New York rules, we're going to have a hard time being substantively identical to the New York rules. And so I think there's some additional drafting consideration that needs to be made here as well. I don't think there's a question there, Mr. Chair. I guess it's more of a comment. Okay. But I'd be interested if there is a fiscal note on this bill to see it.
Mr. Chair? Okay. I believe Fire Marshal Brace would like to respond to that because I don't think there's any problem with the New York rules.
Brace?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if my testimony indicated there was a problem with the New York rules, I believe that they're some of the most thoroughly researched and examined rules ever written by any state government agency in the United States. My only point was that there is a time delay so that we can gain some firsthand experience. But I do not believe there's any fundamental problem with the New York rules. I salute the New York Fire Marshal, he's called the Fire Commissioner, for attempting to write such a difficult standard. And I know that he searched for a number of different entities, both in and outside this country, to develop that standard. So.
Okay.
Thank you for allowing me to clarify that.
Okay. Representative Sikora.
My question is similar. If you explained it, I kind of missed it. What are the New York rules? Can you just give me the highlights so I have some idea of what I'm voting for, since I'm voting for the New York rules, but I don't know what they are?
Mr. Brace.
Mr. Chairman, we would hope that you would vote for it, and it would be based
3 years since then, 3.5 years. Not one state, not one country in the world has chosen to go this route, literally from Maine to California. I've testified in those states. Every other state so far has said, no, we're not going there yet. We're not going to jump off this fiscal and commercial cliff until we see what happens to New York when it lands. Will they have a sprained ankle? Will it be a smooth landing, or will there be a lot of broken bones? Minnesota has that luxury, especially because we're talking about some New York regulations that are scheduled to take effect in June of this year, not some years from now, June of this year. And there's a lot of good, very good reasons to wait and see what happens there. One is that the federal agencies that have studied this problem and the federal government put millions of dollars into research on what might be done in this area, concluded with a report to Congress, and I brought a copy, happy to share it, in which the Consumer Product Safety Commission reported, and I quote, "It is unclear that such a standard will effectively address the number of cigarette-ignited fires." There were also warnings that if any change occurs to the cigarette smoke that increases toxicity, that would easily dwarf the potential harm or potential benefits of fewer fires. Specifically in reference to New York, the Consumer Product Safety Commission issued another statement, Federal Register, October of last year, just a few months ago. Speaking about New York, quote, the extent to which lower IP, that's ignition propensity, cigarettes may reduce the risk of ignition of upholstered furniture and other household furnishings is currently unknown. Federal agency speaking. So the action in Washington now is on federal furniture fire resistance standards, because furniture's what's not supposed to burn. There can't be a fire safe cigarette as long as it's something you light to smoke. In Minnesota, also, it's important to know, and this is terrific, that the number of fires, careless smoking fire deaths, has dropped. And last year, it was at 6 compared to 15 or 20 often in the past, and there has been a consistent downward trend. That's terrific, and there's only so much, I'm sorry to say, but you know it better than I as legislators, that you can do to stop some kinds of foolish and careless behavior. One of the concerns that's been raised at the federal level is what happens to the cigarette smoke. I do know, although the products have not yet hit the market and there's a great deal of testing still going on, that the New York cigarettes will not have decreased tar, nicotine, and carbon monoxide. Everything indicates there will be increases. When Representative Osmond or one of the other previous witnesses referred to these speed bumps and reduction in oxygen, when that kind of thing happens, you get inefficient combustion. It's like if your car engine isn't burning with a good hot spark, you get dirty smoke. And that seems to be the case, everything suggests so far. There's enormous economic implications involved here as well. Reference was made to cigarettes being out in the market already. I believe that was a reference to a Philip Morris product that has put out into the market technology that's intended to, that has these speed bumps. Well, two things about it. One, it doesn't pass New York. 10 out of 14 times when tested by New York, it did not pass their standard. I've got the New York report on that, happy to provide it. Also, that brand has dropped by half or more in its sales since it adopted that technology. I've spent a lot of time in New York, as you might expect, on this, and one thing I've seen firsthand is how scared the New York Department of Tax and Finance is about where this is going to leave them. I've heard from them scenarios about 40% drop in their state direct tax collections before you take into account indirect effects. And on that subject, the New York retailer community is looking at, and they've issued a study where they project 10 to 17,000 jobs. They go through the indirect loss of revenue to the state, and you can imagine how serious that is. So in connection with a fiscal note for this, I would certainly urge that whoever has that responsibility contact the New York Department of Tax and Finance, because they've been through this, at least as best one can project, before June when this hits the fan and we see how this shakes out. Timing is another issue. This has a January 1, currently, 2005 effective date. We appreciate some indications of that being up for discussion, because that won't work. There isn't enough capacity for this paper that people are working with for New York. And the manufacturer of that is a single U.S. company who has raised its prices, last I heard, 13-fold. Given what appears to be a monopoly. The bill also doesn't currently provide for enforcement authority or penalties. And the major manufacturers try to be responsible corporate citizens and cooperate with local law. One of the new developments in the cigarette industry is a lot of new entrants coming in and coming and going on a rapid basis, and they're in and out and don't comply. So I think that's something that also needs to be considered in connection with this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Someone needs to answer their phone. Thank you, Mr. Gould. What we're going to have to do right now, though, is I know you're from out of town, but Mr. Bryant, now you're local, right?
Yes.
Okay. We are over our time limit right now, and we have a long list of people with questions as well. So it's clear that we're not going to be able to wrap this up in the next 30 seconds. So what I think what we'll have to do is we're going to be recessing, and then this evening at 5 p.m. we'll be reconvening at 300 North. 300 North at 5 o'clock, and the first bill we're going to take up actually is going to be the Haas bill, the MSHA bill, and we've got to do that at 5 o'clock. As soon as we're done with the MSHA bill, we will pick up where we left off with the Osment bill. So that's what we'll do, 5 o'clock, 300 North. Any other announcements? See none? We will recess until 5 p.m. All right.
typically is going in the repair.
First of all, I understand.
It's 28 years before the committee to get the bill today. Oh, it is before our committee. Okay, so it has actually before the committee. Officially, it's in our possession.
Yes, it is.
2800. Okay. All right. All right. What?
Oh, they're all, everybody has a time.
No, but you don't need to be here for just a couple minutes.
Are you coming back now then?
What does that mean?
The chair of the committee.
Well, I have the first two bills up. We're taking this one and that one first.
Okay, so you're not leaving to go anywhere else.
No, I'm going to go sit here and you're going to call me.
Well, I know what happens when that goes on. I just want to do bills up to other committees.
What?
We need to have a hearing on the bills that are being paid.
We're going to just present the two and put them in your mind on Friday when I put them together. So I'll compare and contrast what the recommendation of the legislation is and what I've been working on.
I agree, the current situation is powerful. I hear it from all over the place, and frankly,
I will place it gently.
Fortunately, know very little about it now. Hey, child support, I don't know anybody who does. It's a very important issue. It's desperately broken. You know, I know the constituents call me. What you hear about for any
funding?
I don't have an ideological view of that. I just want to make sure that public policy.
So what you like?
You can start.
Well, there's representatives here.
All right, I see we have a quorum, so I'm starting today. Given the fact that we have High Representative Lippman, you're counted.
Going to another committee for a bill.
You have to touch the table according to committee rules now. All right, that's good enough, if that's for me. Okay, again, we'll call the committee to order here. Representative Burrell will move the minutes of the March 9th meeting. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion carries. The minutes are adopted. Representative Holberg, good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, we're going to deal with two bills at the front of the meeting today. That would be House File 2155 and House File 2800. My intent, just for some background information, is generally this committee puts together an omnibus data practices bill each year. This year, in consultation with Senator Betzel, we will have two data practices bills that will move to the floor. The first bill, which is more regular as we've done in the past, will be carried by Representative Burrell and will have a variety of small changes to various areas of Chapter 13. The second bill, which I will carry, will be a combination of House Files 2155 and House File 2800, and they will deal exclusively with electronic databases, most prevalent of which is the CRIVNET and criminal justice databases. So we'll review House File 2155 and House File 2800 today, lay both of them on the table, and then on Friday we'll come back with a delete all that will be a compilation of those two bills to move forward. It is my intent that that bill would have no fiscal note, but if there's a discrepancy regarding that on Friday, my bill may move through Judiciary Finance before it goes to the floor. With that said, I'd like to move House File 215 to be considered by the committee at this time. Mr. Whitehead is here on behalf of the administration to speak to this bill. If you recall, this bill was presented to us in January, I believe, by Mr. Sikora, who chaired the working group on data practices under CRIMNET. This is the administration's proposal to the committee. And if Mr. Whitehead would like to present to the committee at this time, and then following his remarks, then I see here there's a number of testifiers, and I don't know if it's appropriate for them today or on Friday. But I'll also explain my bill as well.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Holberg. House File 2155 is now before the committee. Good afternoon, Mr. Whitehead. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ron Whitehead. I'm an employee of the Department of Public Safety. Recently employed. Before that, in my former life, I was the worked for the Bloomington Police Department, retired as deputy chief there after 29 and a half years, and over that period spent a considerable portion of my time dealing with data practices issues. So from time to time, I've been involved in that and served on the data practices subcommittee of the Juvenile and Criminal Justice Task Force, and in fact was a delegate to the Juvenile and Criminal Justice Task Force on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. What I would like to tell you about House File 2155 is that essentially this makes up the recommendation that came out of the subcommittee, the Data Practices Subcommittee of the Juvenile and Criminal Justice Task Force that was chaired by Bob Sikora, one of the chairs of that task force, and was the product of considerable period of work throughout the year and with a lot of involvement of the various stakeholders to come up with something that would address the issues with respect to CRIMNET, how that might be approached, and how we might facilitate the promulgation of that system without overly, you know, without creating problems as we bring about a statewide system out. Now, what I'll tell you is subdivision one of House File, excuse me just a second, let me get the copy of the bill here. The 2155, I grabbed the wrong copy of the bill. Can I have a copy of the bill? Okay. Changes to the Data Practices Act that are created by that are basically taking the CRIMNET provisions and fashioning a statutory scheme that deals specifically with CRIMNET. Given the fact that that CRIMNET is a unique animal, it's a new process that's being rolled out on behalf of the state and integrating local law enforcement records. To start out with, subdivision one or section one of that bill provides for the implication of judicial records when they're brought out as part of CRIMNET. In other words, the court system defines data practices with respect to their records. However, when those records are incorporated into the CRIMNET backbone and presented to law enforcement and governmental entities, various people that have access to that, it provides that the traveling data provisions of Chapter 13 are applicable. In other words, the classification of that data by the judicial branch of government will be maintained as they come through into the data practices. There is that potential for some conflict between the Data Practices Act, which presumptively makes everything public, and provides that the court's classification of that data will be carried through. Subdivision 2 provides for limited access to Subdivision 2 provides for limited access to local CRIMNET from federal, state, local, and state criminal justice agencies, and also the public defenders. Again, provides for the traveling data aspects and defines CRIMNET data as the data that's contained, and also makes a new classification with respect to audit trail data. And audit trail data is a classification of data that's unique to computerized records where you're able to track through the queries that are made for that against that data. provides that the audit data is protected non-public data and confidential data, and it's only accessed for the purpose of follow-up with respect to the CRIMNET data. Also provides access to the data subjects, and this is the heart of the CRIMNET provisions here that were worked out by the committee, provides access to CRIMNET data by data subject. So in other words, a data subject that would go to an agency that has access to CRIMNET would be able to get a printout of what agencies have contributed data to CRIMNET. The request could be made to a state or local law enforcement agency, and provides that the subject of that data would get a listing of agencies that have supplied data to CRIMNET, and also provides, again, for the provision where a subject of data who believes that there's been some abuse of data can make a complaint to the CRIMNET office and have a verification of who's made access to data and what that's been used for. Sections 3 through 5 in 2155 relate to suspense data. That's been an ongoing problem that's been before the Juvenile Criminal Justice Task Force, and also before the legislature. Here is the suspense data, or the incomplete records maintained by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. It makes changes to that particular data that essentially provide for additional opportunities to provide fingerprints with respect to criminal history data, opportunities for the police department, the courts, the prosecutors to come back and identify records and clear up the suspense files with respect to the criminal history records maintained by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. In large part, that comes out of the necessity to make sure there's a positive identification with respect to that data and avoid the potential for a misidentification with respect to those items. Again, like I say, that deals with Section 3 through 5. Section... Okay, and then Section 6 goes on to provide access to essentially to the Public Defender's Office with respect to CRIMNET. The thought behind that provision, expanding what was at one time access to the criminal history records and data with respect to a client of the Public Defender's Office, was to give the public defenders broader access to witness information or criminal conviction information that might be available through CRIMNET, thus we're making the system a little bit more efficient, providing that public defenders would have access to the data that they're entitled to under the rules of criminal procedure. Finally, Section 8 deals with the Juvenile Criminal Justice Task Force and requires that task force to go on and do an additional inquiry into the various data practices issues with respect to CRIMNET and the potential in the future. And what I would tell you is that with respect to public access, that continues to be a problem of how broadly that should be, in particular when that access comes out of a broadly based database system. And the feeling of the committee was that we need to, as CRIMNET moves along, we need to investigate that data, investigate the implications of broadly making some of that data available on a public basis. So again, I would just summarize the substance of the proposal that came out of the committee was to make it accessible to data subjects. That's key to verifying information, is that data subjects would be entitled to get access to the CRIMNET data to the point they could find out who is providing data on them to the CRIMNET system. They would still have to go to local agencies or other agencies providing that data and verify, you know, get into the detail of the data and correct that data. As far as public access, the committee is not recommending public access to the CRIMNET data at this point, but instead recommending that the committee have be required to do further research on that and come back to the legislature with a report as to how best to deal with that issue, especially when you're talking about how best to deal with it when you're talking about internet access.
Thank you, Mr. Whitehead. Are there any questions of the witness? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Whitehead. Representative Holberg, I have on my witness list the same group of folks under both 2155 and 2800, so I'll just rely on you to call the witnesses as you see fit.
Mr. Chair, none of the testifiers contacted me directly. I'm making the assumption that they want to testify against 2800 as opposed to 2155 is my guess. So I don't know.
Let me rephrase my question. Do you have any other witnesses you'd like to present on behalf of 2155?
I do not.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience here today who wishes to speak in favor of House File 2155? Anyone who wishes to speak in opposition to House File 2155? Seeing none, is there any committee discussion on House File 2155? Seeing none, Representative Holberg, do you have any final comments?
No, I'll renew my motion that House File 2155 be recommended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the criminal justice data practices bill.
That the chair lays House File 2155 on the table. Representative Holberg, House File 2800.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and many of you are well aware of the fact that I've become very concerned about various issues around data practices, particularly in the CRIMNET and criminal justice area, and many of my concerns were, in fact, echoed in the latest legislative auditor's report that was just released last week. And first, I want to recognize the work of Mr. Sikora and his committee in putting together House File 2155. This was not an easy process. They worked long and hard, and all their versions were published on the Internet, available for all to see. And I think they had quite a large group. And I know for myself how hard this has been working with a small group of people putting a bill together. And my recommendations are in no way a criticism of the work that they've done, but rather hopefully an expansion and maybe a different view of some of the issues that they have addressed, and also other issues that I feel should be addressed by the legislature at this time. What we did in House File 2800 is we basically, if you could envision the bill involving three boxes, one being the large overreaching box, that being information systems across state agencies. As we have evolved from a system where we keep records on paper to electronic format, in some instances our current Data Practices Act does not reflect or respond to that changing dynamic in keeping records. And so sections 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 try to address the large picture, and that we put some definitions in place. And also, we look to the Department of Administration and Mr. Gemberling's office to begin to do some oversight and evaluation of electronic database systems throughout the state systems. And what we're asking that they do is, through a period of review, first review the criminal justice information systems for compliance with Chapter 13, and then present to the legislature by next year a scope and sequencing process where they would begin to review the data systems in, say, Health and Human Services, Department of Agriculture. I mean, all of our agencies are using government data and sharing it back and forth and storing it in various ways, and that we need to get a handle on, number one, how we're doing this, but number two, when we're investing in technology updates, we are spending millions and millions and millions and sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars in this area as taxpayers are supporting this. But what we're finding is that in some instances, very little attention is being paid to the ability of technology to help administer the Data Practices Act. And that if simple things were done up front, in the designing of the systems before the investments were made, we would avoid many problems and additional expenses as a result. So we're trying to get to a point where when we're making technology investments that the issues of data practices are addressed, and so this bill attempts to do that. And the second box, if you will, related to this bill is around the specific issue of CRIMNET. And some of the changes that I make in the bill to what's being presented in House File 2155 revolve around the issues of subjects' access to data and also audit trail information. And in the case of the 2155, they make all of the audit trail data classified as non-public confidential, and it's the approach that I take relative to that is that data subjects should be able to have access to what agencies are looking into information on them, and if they want the name of the person that has made the inquiry, they can make the request of the agency that holds the data. That agency can either provide the information or take the issue to administrative law judge process. The other difference in our bills is that relative to data access, data subject access, is that in the recommendations in 2155, the recommendation is that an individual seeking information on themselves would only be given a list of the agencies that hold data on them. My bill allows for more information, and that the data subject would not only have the agencies but also have access to actually what is contained in the criminal or in the CRIMNET system. One of the issues that was brought to light last fall is that it was nearly impossible to actually see what was on the screen. They were happy to provide the names again of the agencies that contributed the data, but in my mind, going to a particular police department and finding out what incidents were involved is completely different than knowing exactly what data was uploaded into the system that was accessible by many people. And the third part of this bill is one of probably the more controversial issues related to the bill is that I make an attempt to, if in fact backing up a little bit, the multiple jurisdiction network organization was shut down by the Minnesota Chief of Police Association sometime in December. Since that time, Commissioner Stanek has stated publicly and in discussions with him between the two of us that their agency is working on reviving a similar data sharing process for law enforcement, and I wholly support that effort, as I think there are very many important uses for that, and it is a very important tool for public safety. But I think that given the experience of the previous system, we know that there are many opportunities for great abuse of such a system. So the third part of the bill addresses what could be future criminal justice information sharing systems similar to an MJNO, and putting some parameters on what could be included in that system, how it could be shared, and how it could be used. Another issue that my bill addresses that is not addressed in 2155 is the issue of what they're referring to as subscription services. They have talked to us, the people at CRIMNET, about the possibility or ability of this system to be able to allow an individual who has proper access and clearance, of course, to subscribe to any data that is entered into the system at any time on a particular individual. In the case of probation officers, that would be a really good tool. If you were going to let somebody out on probation and you could say to them, now, your probation officer is going to have a key into the system, and any time you have contact with any law enforcement agency that's involved or hooked into CRIMNET, your actions are immediately going to be sent to your probation officer That's a good thing. That's a very powerful tool. I think it's important. In the hands of somebody with the wrong motivations, in my mind, it's akin to a type of search warrant on a person's actions. And so in my bill, I attempt to define the parameters of when and how subscription services could be used and provide for a limited period of time in which a law enforcement official could subscribe to a person's data without their knowledge, and then allow for a process similar to achieving or getting a search warrant to have some type of court action to allow for that subscription service to continue beyond initial period of time. And that it's seems to be one of the more controversial areas of the bill in initial discussions. On Monday of this week, we had a meeting with a number of representatives from the public safety, law enforcement. Bob Johnson from CrimNet was there, Department of Corrections. So we're trying to meet some of those concerns, but in my mind, the thought that somebody could have law enforcement keyed into their every actions for an extended period of time without any judicial review of that, it, to me, it, allows for some problems. It also requires training so that when we have people that have access to this important tool, that they at least have to have some training before they do that. And I'm fully aware that this bill is not in its perfect form. At this point, there are some concerns with it, but I wanted to at least bring it forward to the committee today. We'll compile the bill on Friday. I'm assuming that these three gentlemen on the list would probably like to come up and testify in opposition to my bill. One of the main concerns about it is the cost, and as I said earlier in my presentation, it is my intent that this bill have no fiscal cost, but they're pushing for a study. It is not my intent to turn this whole thing into a study. I think that there are important parts of the 2800 that don't need studying, that are a matter of policy, that should be addressed by this legislature this session before we move any farther along in the development of CrimNet or any other criminal justice information sharing systems that are on the drawing board at this time.
Thank you, Representative Holbert. Just to make it official, I don't think we've moved the bill yet, so the chair will move House File 2800 to get it before the committee for discussion. Any questions for the author? Seeing none, is there anybody with us today who would like to speak in favor of House File 2800? Is there anybody who wishes to speak in opposition to House File 2800? Going once, going twice. Mr. Whitehead.
Again, Ronald Whitehead. And I need to clarify the fact I'm not speaking on behalf of the Department of Public Safety. I'm not sure what the commissioner's position is here, but speaking from my experience as a police officer of 31 years and being involved in the subject, I do want to point out that House File 2800 clearly was not before the Data Practices Committee of the Criminal Justice and Juvenile Justice Task Force. It has some broad implications, and this brings up a point that I've made reference to frequently in that setting, is that we need to maintain a careful balance we don't. The data practices is driving the technology. What you have, and Hennepin County is a prime example of a county that's trying to automate and create some efficiencies and bring together databases, but has distinctly taken the position that we're not going to warehouse any data, because then we'll be involved in managing, in certification and managing a data practices plan. In other words, there will be no collection of data at that point, and that's exactly what CrimNet is about, is bringing that information available and making it available. In other words, because of the burdensome provisions of the Data Practices Act, there are people taking a position technology-wise, that as far as storing data, we're not going to store any data. We're just going to transport that data. In reviewing 2800, and I haven't had a chance to go over it in detail, I'd point out a couple of different things. It clearly talks about certifying computer systems. I am not aware of anywhere where there's any provisions in the Data Practices Act or in regulations that distinctly tell you what needs to be done with respect to a computer or automated database or an information system. There clearly, the Data Practices Act clearly talks about procedures as far as providing access to public data and private data. In the case of Bloomington, where I'm very familiar with the Data Practices Act, there, those procedures are largely procedures when somebody comes and asks for access to data. The police officers and the clerks there provide the access to the data in accordance with procedure, and there is no implications directly with respect to the to our automated systems. And we comply with the Data Practices Act by when somebody comes and asks for access to the data, we pull the data and we provide them access with the data in accordance to law. My point being is, I'm not sure when they say certifying a system to be compliant with the Data Practices Act exactly what you're talking about, and it would be more appropriate, I would say, to start to what are we talking about as far as being certified, or are we talking about procedures in every agency for complying to the Data Practices Act? So we're talking about one thing and yet talking about certifying computer databases and so forth. The other provisions, as I read through the law, I looked at setting up a court-based system to very similar for a court order to be entitled to subscribe to a system. To be a subscriber, it seemed to be extremely cumbersome and would be inhibiting to law enforcement and limit the use of some of those systems. I would urge you to return these things to the Juvenile Criminal Justice Task Force and let them work through these things. Don't let the Data Practices Act derive the policy totally. Obviously, I, having served on other committees with the Juvenile Criminal Justice Task Force, I was on the Strategic Planning Committee, and we made a significant commitment in the strategic plan to address data practices and assure that a portion of the funding as in the CRIMNET process should be directed at compliance with the Data Practices Act. Beyond that, I'll say that 2800 to me really affects virtually every record system in the state, and you'd be surprised, obviously, that there's many small departments that are maintaining their record systems on just an access database. They don't have sophisticated systems. It would apply to them, and again, I would tell you that it's their procedures that are applicable. It's not their system that needs to be certified. And the laws are in place for the IPAD, the Information Policy Administrative Division, to look at their policies and see if their policies comply with data practices in that respect.
Questions for the witness? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Whitehead.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Please.
Mr. Whitehead talked about not having a clear understanding of issues that the administration would review relative to compliance. Just in very general terms, we had a system that was operating last fall. There was a 10-page memo from Mr. Gemberling. We're talking about things entering into contracts outside the state of Minnesota with entities that don't have to apply with the Data Practices Act. We talk about simple security measures and whether or not the public has access to confidential matters. We talk about how are they following the procedures for data subject access to data. There are a lot of issues that are not being addressed in a comprehensive manner. And I don't think that asking or taking a look at compliance with the Data Practices Act is an unnecessary process at this time, given what we're learning about what's going on with use of technology and government information. We have a very, very high responsibility when we hold data on individuals in this state to make sure that we respect their rights to that information. And sometimes, believe it or not, people that are involved in these systems would benefit from an outside, independent person taking a look at their practices and procedures for compliance. And that's just what I'm trying to get at. We have an information policy system division in the state of Minnesota for a reason. And the reason being is the legislature at some time determined that adherence to the Data Practices Act was an important thing, and that there should be a department to provide training and advice to not only government agencies, but to members of the public. And the reality is that in this fast-moving age of updates and technology and the things that we can do with it, we are not paying enough attention to the use of the Data Practices Act in that context. And the Legislative Auditor's Report was very clear on this issue. We have invested nearly $200 million in the CRIMNET system. And that's just CRIMNET. How much have we invested in our education department, in the Department of Health, in our school districts? I'm aware of a school district that just spent millions of dollars to get the technology to convert their paper records to an electronic format. And guess what? Did they pay attention to the Data Practices Act so when they did this, they would be able to use that electronic format to sort their data according to the Data Practices Act? For a slightly higher investment, they would have been able to do that. But no, they paid all this money so they didn't have boxes of paper in a storage room. Well, if they paid a little bit more, they would have been able to automate a system of access to records that would have saved them a lot of time, employee time, for years to come. But this is not being done out there. And it's in my mind, it's an important issue. It should not all be relegated to another study for another year while we spend another, I don't know how many gazillion dollars on new computers, new software, new policies. The time is now to begin framing what we feel as policymakers are the important components of moving from a paper data system to an electronic data system, because quite frankly, we as policymakers are way behind what's actually going on out there in the field.
Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually have a question for Mr. Whitehead. Mr. Whitehead, would it be your opinion that if the CRIMNET system followed some of the Chapter 13 requirements, that the officers of the court and the investigators and the police departments would not be able to do their job to round up the criminals that the system is designed to go after and find?
Mr. Whitehead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would not take the position that compliance with the Data Practices Act inhibits us from doing our duty or doing a law enforcement job. And I would submit to you that most every agency is making an honest attempt to do that in their procedures and so forth. I would say that some of the restrictions in 2800 may have that impact on the subscription service and some of those things. And clearly from the prospect of the commissioner's ability, the commissioner Ladman's ability to shut down a system, that clearly would have an impact upon law enforcement and our ability to do our job. So I would walk cautiously there in that respect. Again, harkening back to exactly what is the certification process when we're talking about compliance with the Data Practices Act and pulling the plug on systems is something that I would take very cautiously in that respect. The other one I would tell you is that as people are designing systems, they are not, they are looking at the burden that's required in some respects to address Data Practices Act, and they're not designing systems that are truly going to be beneficial. And I will harken back to Hennepin County, where you would think that a consolidated database in Hennepin County would be very beneficial. And on a broad basis, people are staying away from that because they don't want to be confronted with the burden of managing that data, in particular managing that data with respect to public access. That can become a very, very broad burden as far as the media and other people coming in and saying, give me everything public in your database.
Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Whitehead, I have just a follow-up on, I recently was borrowing some money and put a mortgage on my house, and one of the forms they filled out said, the main thing on this form is check and make sure the address of your property is correct. Well, it wasn't, and it hasn't been correct for 5 years. It took the closing of the loan ceased, and it took a few days to straighten that whole mess out. As a citizen who might be in your CRIMNET system, don't we have a right to access that data and make sure that it's accurate or correct on us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burrell, I would agree with you absolutely that that's the case. And in fact, if you look at the recommendations of the CRIMNET or the Data Practices Task Force, that measures to provide for that individual's access to the data is not only in the benefit of the individual, but is also in the benefit of law enforcement and other people using the system to assure, and providing that individual with access to follow up is key. So I think everybody would uniformly agree to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Whitehead. I do have a list of witnesses, as I mentioned, for both these house files, and I perhaps caused some confusion before by simply querying the audience. So I will go through the list, and certainly if you have something you feel would add to the value of the debate here, step forward. Bob Johnson, Director of CRIMNET, are you here today? Do you wish to testify? Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Welcome.
This is Mr. Storkamp from CRIMNET.
Storkamp, well, he's not on the list. He doesn't exist. He doesn't exist.
Thank you for asking the audience, Chair.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Dan Storkamp. I'm the IT manager for the Department of Corrections. Bob Johnson wasn't able to make it here, or this, and I'm going to sit in. Fill some big shoes here for a moment. First of all, I'd like to thank Madam Chair for her openness in working with us this week on this bill, and she mentioned there's a few areas of concern that we've shared with her, and we're working through those over the next few days. I think the big issue for us, again, is the costs and the impact of some of these things with CRIMNET, but not just CRIMNET, but the other agency systems that feed CRIMNET in the process. I do want to mention and make clear that CRIMNET and the Criminal Justice Policy Group has passed a motion that CRIMNET will follow data practices. That is a part of our strategic plan. So that is no different than what Mary Liz, or Madam Chair, is presenting before today, is that we want to make sure that as we move forward with CRIMNET, we're doing that. The first attempt is the next bill that you will be hearing. We had a committee get together, talk about those issues, and those issues we're bringing forward. Part of that, in addition, is to look beyond just that first step. There's a whole slew of issues that CRIMNET will need to be dealing with as we move forward. As we move forward, we also have to realize CRIMNET is a compilation of systems. Many of those systems already comply with data practices. For example, in the statewide supervision system, which probation and jail information is accessible to law enforcement and criminal justice professionals, we do have a statute for data practices that we are a part of. And we'd welcome a review to make sure that we're following data practices in that process. And I think anybody in the criminal justice system would. So with that, we do have some concerns with the bill, but we're working with Mayor Liz and Madam Chair as we move forward with that.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a question. You said that the CRIMNET working group passed a motion saying that they were going to comply with the data practice. Why was that necessary?
Mr. Storkamper.
Storkamp, Mr. Chair.
Storkamp.
Correct.
I got it.
Madam Chair, Representative, the policy group went on record to be, there was a lot of questions about CRIMNET complying with data practices along the way, and they wanted to make it well known that their intent, and these are the managers or the group that's coordinating above, that data practices is an important part of CRIMNET, and as such is a part of the strategic plan. So as we move forward and this information system moves from testing and into implementation, that those issues surrounding subscription, as Madam Chair points out, and other issues are dealt with. So that became a critical part of our strategic plan.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd just comment that I don't think a motion to comply with state law ought to be necessary, but I'm glad that they've decided to comply.
Duly noted. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Gemberling, I recognize you. Do you wish to add anything to the discussion today?
Mr. Chair, no, not at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Mr. Neumeister, here today. Mr. Neumeister, good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. I would also note for the witnesses that this committee has heard extensive testimony in the past. We know how the CRIMNET system works with the spines and the buckets and all that other good stuff. So if you could refrain from any testimony regarding that, that would certainly be appreciated given the fact that this house is under deadline. Now, Mr. Neumeister, good afternoon. If you'd state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. 2800 is a very important bill. For 11 years, I've served on the criminal justice information and juvenile justice information deal, task force. Approximately about 6 years ago, with starting of $180 million, according to the LAC, legislative auditor, that's the term, that's how much money, whether it's cumulative, a county, or state, or whatever, they started to develop CRIMNET. And I served as a citizen member on this task force, and I've been, as I've been called, a pain, a this, a that, a lot on data practices. Secondly, I've gone through various kinds of subcommittee groups dealing with data practices, trying to get whoever was the person that asked that question to get CRIMNET and all its entities as it starts doing those interconnections to comply with the law. And we're still trying to deal with that. And as the LAC report says, that's still one of the things that you need to do. So the issue now is before you. Yes, 2800, to my understanding, there is some fiscal thing. But if you're putting in $180 million or whatever the figure you want to use for CRIMNET to work right, you've got to invest some money at the beginning to make sure the information management system is there, whether it be for the criminal justice information management system, or the general information management systems. Again, I've been around for two decades plus, and I can tell you there's a long line of information management systems that don't do what myself and others, including Representative Holberg, are trying to do, is to make it to comply, to get it at the beginning rather than a year or two down the line. It costs money. So that part of the 2800, I think, is good for that accountability, and that may cost money. The issue is, how much money is there, how much cost, or whatever. Now, the other aspect, as you know, MJNO came out. From my perspective, it was creating a database of information that nobody really knew what's happening. I knew about it and those folks because it was going to be linked up with CRIMNET. Now, the thing is that through efforts of a number of legislators who were interested when they started hearing about MJNO, and with Representative Holberg being one of those folks, they tried to see, well, how can we start doing some accountability for that? And that's what's also in 2800. And I think goes towards that. Still, when I look at, and I guess you want a testimony on both bills at the same time? That's how you were.
It's certainly, Mr. Newmark.
Encouraging?
Sure.
2155. Aspects are not too clear for me in a statewide system how an individual is really going to be able to get access to their information and to contest the accuracy and completeness of it. I am for the study, but the issue is if you adopt some of the principles that are in 2800, you may not necessarily have to have that year study to come back with a report. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it's important to grasp with some policies here, and I don't know what you've all decided. I do have my preferences, and my understanding was that, and I don't know if it still is, this bill will be up again on Friday, to where after hearing all the input, you, the policymakers, getting and hearing input, will put together a bill that at least can get things started going forward and up. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, those are my points in that regards, and I can ask any specific kind, I can answer any specific questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Mr. Sikora, I notice you're on the list as well today. Do you care to make any comments with respect to either of these bills?
No, Mr. Chairman, nothing.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sikora. Is Mike Garris with us this afternoon? Good afternoon, Mr. Garris. If you would state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Mike Garris, the Executive Director of LOGIS. LOGIS is a joint powers agency, political subdivision of the state. But think of us just as a large intergovernmental information systems agency, 26 cities and a county. We've been around for 31 years. The purpose of that is to share information systems like financial systems, utility billing, property data, GIS systems, etc. But for a number of years, we've also been sharing public safety systems. The primary one is the record systems. We also do dispatch and mobile computing out of the cars, squad cars. For the last 10 years, LOGIS has actually shared its record system information, criminal history and criminal justice information amongst 18 agencies and our county, which would classify LOGIS in, I think, that third box, the one of the criminal justice statewide systems area. In 2800, that would limit all of these agencies to only be able to share using the same system of LOGIS, so the same records management system, to four data elements: name, address, date of birth, and case number. So if you're an investigator in one city, let's say Richfield, and you're going to look at the record system, you can certainly see all of your information. But if you find that there's somebody else has a name, let's say at Dakota County, you would only be able to find the name, address, and date of birth. You would not be able to any longer rely on the record system that is shared. Dakota County Sheriff's Office, you also using the LOGIS records management system, could not respond. You'd have to actually use the phone or the fax then to do some fairly serious criminal investigation. I don't think it was the bill's intention to really slow down the investigative process to where you've got to use a phone or a fax machine. You know, I think an information system really is just an electronic form of a record-keeping system anyway. So that information is going to be shared. It's just that now the investigators may have to either send paper records back and forth or use the phone or the fax machine. What I'm talking about here, by the way, is under Section 8, Subdivision 2, I believe it's Paragraph D, that just says that you can only share four pieces of information. So I'd really like that to be looked at. I think it has some serious ramifications for if you've got all these agencies trying to really cooperate on an investigation, these communities really sharing in the system, can now not share electronically very quickly that kind of critical data they need to make arrests. It's going to be a burden, I think, to all of those agencies. So that's my primary area of concern in this bill, and I guess I'd like to really have you seriously consider that aspect of the bill. Also, cost on a local level, of course, is our concern, as well as has been pointed out. There would be a lot of bucks to unbundle that system and making sure that the agencies can now only share those four data elements. We'd have to really spend a lot of money. This is a national system for Motorola, so we had to convince them to do it and then have to pay them a whole bunch of dollars to make that happen. So we have that concern as well. And then one last point, and that is if LOGIS ties its records system to other systems, for example, right now working on tying our records management system into, let's say, Hennepin County Attorney's Office, so that we can quickly send incident reports to them on a suspect we have held in a local jail, so that they can make a determination whether to file criminal charges or not. You worry about then we're creating a integrated system between our record system and the Hennepin County's leading edge system. That integration piece has to be shared amongst both agencies. Then do we maybe also create a multi-jurisdictional agency system of that whole thing, and therefore that falls underneath this section, which means we shouldn't be sharing that information electronically. So that's basically my comments on it and my concerns.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Holbert,
the issue of the limit of the four data data elements. This was to be, the intent was is that if you were putting together similar to an MJNO where you would upload into a system in order to provide a pointer file or a directory as what was one of the explanations that was given to us at some point in the evolution of the descriptions of what MJNO was and wasn't, that this would provide for that directory in order to make the contact with the agency that holds the data. And so that was the intent of this part of the legislation, that we wouldn't have massive amounts of data uploaded into a system where we had thousands of people that had access to it, but rather to constrain, maybe I should back up. I kept asking law enforcement over the last couple of months, well, which way do you want to go? Do you want a system that has tons and tons and tons of information in it and more limited access to it, or would you prefer lots and lots of access with limited information? Not ever getting a clear answer, because of course they want both, lots and lots of information and lots and lots and lots of access. And in order to get the discussion going on this important public policy issue, the bill allows for lots and lots of access to more of a directory, or if you will, a telephone book of where to go to get more information. And my intent is not to preclude the ability of agencies to share information electronically, but rather if you have a system that holds all this information, that it be limited in scope.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. No questions for the witness. Thank you, Mr. Garris. The chair will recognize Dennis Nolan. Is Mr. Nolan here this afternoon? Okay, you're really Mr. Nolan, right?
Yes.
I just want to make sure I get this right this afternoon. I'm a little tired. So. All right. Mr. Nolan, if you'd please identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Nolan, and I work for Hennepin County, their IT department, and for the past 25 years, I administer the Data Practices Act for Hennepin County. And this morning, we realized that we were getting the House file 2800 was on the agenda to be heard today, and so immediately thereafter, I got a lot of company in my office about an analysis of this bill. And we have a committee already established at the county for the criminal committee, and this was kind of a surprise to them. And some of the criticisms that they had of this, not criticisms, but concerns they had for this was that it was, the beginning is so broadly written that they didn't really know where we were going with it and what was going to be the desired result. Second, it does entail a lot of administrative overhead as far as programming and maintaining data systems in compliance with these provisions here. And I believe there was a concern about accuracy and completeness. If by linking the Data Practices Act to any of these bills, the individual always has the right to contest accuracy and completeness of any data about them. And lastly, if I could say that the legislature usually passes a lot of these things with state oversight over local government, but it neglects to fund that oversight, fund the staff necessary to do that. That's all I have, members.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Nolan. Any questions for the witness? Thank you, Mr. Nolan.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, next witness, I have a comment to...
Okay. Let's do that. The chair will recognize Pete Cahill. Is Mr. Cahill with us this afternoon while he makes his way to the podium? Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, current Data Practices Act requires that each agency has a compliance official that is assigned, it's public, and that they have to make regular reports to the Information Policy Systems Division of the State of Minnesota. And so, you know, I mean, I can understand that people are maybe not unhappy, but the reality is if their systems are in compliance with the Data Practices Act, they have nothing to worry about. They're going to continue to file their yearly reports that say that they're in compliance, that they went over this. Mr. Gemberling's office will come back to us next year with their scope and sequencing and how they're going to move forward with review of the different state agency systems, and we're going to move along. I mean, I keep hearing all this resistance. Well, the reality is all we're saying is be in compliance and be able to prove that you're in compliance, and then everybody's happy. And if you're not in compliance, let us know how you're going to get in compliance ASAP.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. The chair recognizes Mr. Cahill. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Cahill. I'm the Chief Deputy County Attorney in Hennepin County. And I haven't had much of a chance to digest this House File 2800, but I was familiar with House File 2155. And the basic response to 2155 is that we can probably work with many of the provisions of that bill. Some people in our county would like to see some amendments even to that bill to more focus the responsibility for taking fingerprints, to make it the primary responsibility of the initiating agency and then the sheriff if they can't. Right now it kind of is thrown all together and it's not clear who has primary responsibility. But other than that, we can live with 2155. My reaction to 2800, to be very honest, I'm not going to parse through the whole bill, is that we're probably just not going to think it's worth it to be a part of CRIMNET. There are a lot of requirements here, not only for state oversight, but by the Department of Administration having complete and unfettered and unreviewable decision-making over our local case management systems. And in doing that, we believe we are in compliance, and Representative Coles, we don't need a resolution, obviously, to be in compliance with data practices. We believe that's very important. We also believe that it's very important that subjects of data have the ability to challenge what is in case management systems. But the requirements that are in here, though, as I leaf through them, would create a great burden on us as a local prosecution office to respond to various data requests and to document every time a system is accessed. We have over 90 prosecutors in our office. Each one of them is checking a system daily to try and prosecute somebody, for example, a domestic abuser who is in custody and who we must charge within 36 hours to have them charged before they can be released. We need to know what their background is to see if we can charge them with a felony, and to have to stop each time we access and to document the reasons why and submit those would bring that to a screeching halt. So that, I'm not sure, I think the staff it would take for us to comply with this would outweigh what we would save by hooking onto CRIMNET. The hope with CRIMNET was that we could save staff time by pushing and pulling data electronically. I have six people who sit in an intake center all day manually keying in data from police departments. Why? Because we are not integrated, because we are not sent these messages electronically. The moment we sign on to an integrated system, then we'll be subject to all these other requirements that I'm not sure any of the efficiencies we would gain through the push and pull of data electronically would outweigh the bureaucratic requirements now in 2800. So I really would have to question whether our agency would participate in CRIMNET if House File 2800 becomes law.
Seeing no questions, Representative Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cahill, I was about to call you Pete, but I'll be more formal here. As I understand it, Hennepin County has about 25% of the population of the state of Minnesota. Is that right, as far as you can recall?
Mr. Cahill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Latz, I believe that is roughly correct, 1.1 million, however that compares.
Representative Latz.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cahill, I think your concerns about the costs of implementing this ought to be heard very clearly, and there ought to be a way to find a balance, I think, between the goals of this legislation and the practical realities of implementing it in a way that doesn't impede law enforcement and doesn't add costs to the system unnecessarily. I'm hoping that Hennepin County and the others concerned with this legislation can work with Representative Holberg to try to strike that balance so we can move forward together rather than being at odds over this kind of policy.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair?
Representative Holberg.
Again, I don't want any fiscal note to this, but the idea that you were tracking everything electronically and that somehow you'd have to have people keep a written log, computers have the ability to keep an electronic log of who goes on when, what information they're accessing, and while the software or the setup of the system currently may not reflect the particulars of 2800, there may be a way in which we can grandfather where we are now, but moving forward and new systems that are implemented or new programs, but have to have the ability to use the technology to keep track of that data trail as well.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Seeing no other questions, thank you, Mr. Cahill. Is there any...
Mr. Chair, could I make one other comment to that? And
certainly, Mr. Cahill.
And that is that these are important issues, and actually we don't disagree with some of the issues that Representative Holberg has brought up in this bill, and that being data practices is very important. It's something we consider. For example, when the statewide supervision system was first put in place, we advised our corrections department not to send juvenile data because we thought it was not in compliance with data practices. And so we are keenly aware of that, and we should discuss that as part of this policy discussion, and we should also discuss the cost. If the state is going to exercise veto authority over our case management system but is willing to provide the resources to fix them, obviously that's something we would very much like to participate in.
Thank you, Mr. Cahill. Thank you, Representative Holberg. Any further committee discussion on House File 2800? Representative Holberg, any final comments with respect to House File 2800?
Members, I know that everybody's busy, but if any of you are so inclined to take the bill in the summary and at least read through it before Friday to be able to provide comment, I'm not saying this is the end-all by any means. I've tried to provoke some discussion around these issues. I'm looking for your input on how you feel that they should be addressed. There are some issues that I feel very strongly about. There's others that we'll be able to be more able to negotiate with. I do have to extend my thanks to Mr. Verdon, Ms. McKnight, Ms. Engler, and Mr. Gemberling, who we have spent hours and hours in rooms going through this information, trying to put together a bill that begins to frame up some of the issues that I feel need to be addressed as soon as possible. And with that, I think you made the motion to put the bill in front of us.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Holberg. With that, the chair lays House File 2800 on the table. Next, Representative Broad. Members, the next bill on the agenda is House File 1819. The chair will move House File 1819 that it be recommended to pass from this committee and placed on the general register. Is that accurate, Representative Broad?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Broad, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. So essentially, House File 1819 is a refinement of current law regarding who is covered under statutes 192.27. The new language essentially extends the coverage to National Guard members who are other than a commanding officer, other officers, or other enlisted members. The second part of the change in language, again, is an attempt to further create clarity within the statute and as to from where these orders may come, essentially refining that definition as well, including the lawful orders and the definition of lawful orders under that section. I do have Lieutenant Colonel John Broussard from the National Guard with the Judge Advocate General's Office here for any specific questions if you have them.
Any questions for the author? Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Colonel, can you tell us have there been instances where individual soldiers were found liable or criminally liable or civilly liable? I'm looking for the need for this bill at this particular point in time. Any soldiers in Minnesota or elsewhere found liable?
Colonel Broussard, if you'd identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed with your answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Broussard. I'm the judge advocate or legal advisor for the Minnesota National Guard. Mr. Representative, Mr. Chair, there have been no charges brought against any member of the Minnesota National Guard.
Representative Biernan.
Mr. Colonel, what about elsewhere, other states? I'm wondering what triggered the interest in this bill and why it's suddenly before us.
Colonel Broussard.
There is a case that caused a good deal of concern around the country that arose in Texas. And it actually involved a Marine, Corporal Benuelis, and he was the head of a group, squad of Marines that were doing drug interdiction patrols along the U.S.-Mexican border. There was a suspected drug lookout whose name was Hernandez, Vizguel Hernandez, and he was being followed by Benuelos and his squad. Hernandez shot twice at the squad and was preparing to shoot a third time when Benuelos shot and killed Hernandez. The shooting was in keeping with all applicable federal regulations that apply to the Marines operations here, including what's called the rules of engagement, which is basically the directions that they receive on use of force. Despite this, there was question raised because the law in the state of Texas for self-defense had a requirement for retreat before using force unless you were within the confines of your own residence. The result was a period of about a year and a half during which there were two state grand juries, a federal grand jury, and two military investigations conducted into the activities and of Corporal Benuelos and his squad of Marines. The final result was that they had acted properly and that there was no criminal charge against them, but it was a significant issue in terms of both the who was going to represent them, because there was questions about whether there was rights to representation, and a variety of other issues that arose out of that that could have been short-circuited or eliminated by a more clear statement of the protections of people acting pursuant to military orders.
Thank you. Representative Broad.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And follow-up to Representative Burnett, too, I appreciate your question. This is an opportunity for Minnesota to play offense as opposed to defense for our National Guard members. We want to make sure that they have the tools and the protections that they need to do the job that we're asking them as we use them in more security-type situations as opposed to what they've been used in the past.
Thank you. Colonel Broussard, you weren't given an opportunity to provide testimony. I assume your testimony revolved around the case you spoke of, the JTF-6 mission down in down along the border in Texas. Is that true? Is there anything else you'd like to add by way of testimony?
Mr. Chairman, it's clear that you're familiar with the case.
Actually, not. I'm the chairman has experience leading JTF-6 missions, so I'm familiar with them.
Okay. Because the citation to the JTF was what caught my ear. No, I'm primarily here to provide information regarding the bill. Clearly, we're interested in our soldiers being able to perform their duties without being caught in a bind between what state law and what federal law require them to do, and making it clear that lawful orders include the federal regulations that they have to follow as well.
Thank you. Any questions for the witnesses? Okay. Any committee discussion? Representative Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if Representative Broad has the answer to this or not. I'm just trying to read through the proposed legislation here. And it looks like there are a couple of standards being applied here. I'm just reading it for the first time, trying to sort this out, but it looks like existing statute on line 1.17 of the Senate file that's provided to us. Is that what we should be looking at?
Representative Broad?
First question. Is it identical to House File 1819 that's provided to us?
As far as I'm aware, but we do have the House File 1819 before us.
Okay, well, let's look at line 17 of the House File 1819. It says an officer must have exercised honest judgment, or the, as added now, military personnel acting under that officer's direction. But then later on in language, in existing statute, seems to already protect officers and enlisted members. for acts done under lawful orders, and then defines lawful orders. So I'm a little confused as to what it is that is necessary to be added here.
Representative Broad or Colonel Broussard?
Thank you. I'll yield to Colonel Broussard to discuss those specific clarifications.
Colonel Broussard.
Okay. The proposed amendment, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, the proposed amendment defines the lawful orders. That was one of the issues you raised. There is no definition in the statute as it exists right now as to what lawful orders would include. And as to the other, the first clause, if you will, suppression of insurrection, dispersion of mob, etc., was interpreted as applying primarily to civil disturbance type activities, where the second would be broader and it would include any actions taken under lawful orders and in the performance of duty. And that could include what has been probably the more common mission that we've performed over the last several years, starting with the airport security mission after 9/11 and proceeding to include the critical infrastructure protection mission of last early spring, late winter, and the airport holiday safeguard mission of this past Christmas season, where it isn't a civil disturbance as such, but more of a protection of citizens when they're in the process of moving through, traveling, things like that, where we might be called upon to prevent injury or death to people in that context, more of a terrorist context.
Thank you, Colonel Broussard. Any further committee discussion? Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel Broussard, if the incident in Texas had been an operation by the Border Patrol or county police, and they followed those same rules of engagement, would there have been the same type of suit? Or is this something that, because they were military, they weren't covered under the Texas law?
Colonel Broussard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burrell, without being intimately familiar with Texas law, I'm going to make some speculations, but in Minnesota, peace officers are trained to perform their duties, and I assume Texas has similar requirements, and they also have certain particular statutory provisions relating to their use of force that don't apply to the military or to other entities, because we don't, frankly, have the same type of training. In Minnesota, you would have looked at it from the perspective of, was that use of force within what's permitted for a peace officer in the prevention of felonies and the reasonable belief that person would continue to pose some sort of threat. If Texas has a similar provision, then arguably a county law enforcement agent would not have had the same issue.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion that House File 1819 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The motion prevails. The recommendation is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Next on our agenda is House File 2442, Representative Swenson. Chair recognizes Representative Swenson. Good afternoon, Representative Swenson. Would you care to move your bill?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, would it be possible to do my other bill first, the testifier for the 2442 is in another committee at the moment.
Certainly. Members, we're going to deviate slightly on the agenda. We will now take up House File 2658, also authored by Representative Swenson, to allow his testifier to testify and hopefully allow the other one to show up. Representative Swenson, would you care to move House File 2658?
Mr. Chairman, I would do that. And I have a delete all amendment that I would like to move. Amendment DE1.
Okay. All right. Representative Swenson moves that House File 2658 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. And now we moves the DE1 amendment. Is there any discussion of the DE1 amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Swenson, your amendment.
Yes. Could I add an oral amendment to the... add three words to this amendment. On page 1, line 8, after the word county, insert or contiguous counties.
Or contiguous counties?
Yes.
Okay.
And that would just be added to the amendment.
Representative Swenson moves the DE1 amendment as amended in order to get the bill in the shape in which he'd like to discuss it. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Swenson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And with that, I'm going to ask Mr. Jerry Schoenfield to explain the bill. And I also have Bruce Claven here with me.
Good afternoon, Mr. Schoenfeld. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I work with the Minnesota Pork Producers Association in Minnesota. And the bill is something of interest to me, not only from the standpoint that dealing with the client's interest in the bill, but it is also something that I have a fair amount of history with. And then I'd like to mention a little bit about that history. Some of you may or may not know that I served in the legislature here some many years ago, and in 1982 was the author of the original legislation that put the ag nuisance protections in. So this bill is consistent with what I believe was the intent at the time. Recently there has been a court decision that brought up a couple of points. Basically what most of this bill does is rearrange some of the original requirements of the bill structurally within the statute. Some of the complaints within the court decision were the fact that definitions, for instance, were not in the operative sections of the statute. So that has been changed. And basically what the bill does is this. It says, for purposes of the subdivision term, generally accepted ag practices means those practices commonly used by their farmers in the county or contiguous counties. What this bill is intended to do is to allow that agricultural operations that do three things have some protection from nuisance lawsuit. First of all, that they be located in an agriculturally zoned area so that it is an ag operation in an ag area. Secondly, that it complies with all provisions of all applicable federal laws, state laws, or county laws, regulations, rules, and ordinances, and any permits issued for the ag operation. And third, that it operates according to the generally accepted ag practices, which I stated were the common practices in the area. If those three requirements are met, then it would provide for an affirmative defense for the ag operation with regard to a nuisance claim. And that really is the extent of the law. I mentioned before a little bit of the history, and one of the reasons I wanted to mention that was because in 1982, when this original law passed, that this is amending, there were, at that time, limited amounts of agricultural zoning in the state. Pretty much everything now that is in agriculture is in an ag-zoned area, not maybe every last thing, but most of it. In addition to that, there was, at that time, a lack of the number of regulations and so forth that farmers now are guided under. The permitting process, for instance, with feedlots didn't exist at that time in the same way that it does today. Today, there's a very extensive permitting process for feedlots. There's a lot of regulation relative to the registration and use of herbicides and those kinds of things. And so there have been some things that have changed. Now, this bill does not protect, and there was a change with regard to the delete all amendment here. There was a question that was raised relative to the question of negligence. And by some people, the original bill had been read to say that if you were negligent in terms of hurting someone or, you know, that if I take my tractor down the road and I run them over somehow, that I was going to be free from the negligence of that. This bill does not do this. This deals with nuisance law, not with injury to people, not with, in terms of if I am negligent and injure someone, certainly I can be sued for that kind of a thing. Certainly other parts of the bill, on the second page, there's a deletion of three items that were in the original law. Again, part of this is because, to make this a little bit more clear, for instance, it does not affect in terms of conditions of injury because you can sue under many other areas for that. Personal injury and so forth. In addition to that, you have to be in compliance with all permits. You have to be in compliance with all laws. And, of course, if I'm outside of that compliance, I'm not covered even under the nuisance section. Thirdly, there was a provision originally in the pollution. If I do pollute, I will be breaking the Clean Water Act. I will be breaking laws relative to all of our MPCA laws in the state. I would be operating outside of my permits. All those kind of things wouldn't be covered under this as well. So it is limited to under 1,000 animal units with regard to a swine capacity. That goes way back to 1982. The reason for that was that it was meant to be dealing with medium and small-sized farms. That has not changed. There's no change there. And then in addition, number three in the second page, it provides that any prosecution for the crime of public nuisance that would be brought by an agency or a township or a county or state, as provided in Section 609, is allowed. That's an exemption to this. And what 609 references is it says interference with privacy, and what it says, a person is guilty of a misdemeanor, excuse me, I apologize, Mr. Chairman, I have got the wrong section here ahead of me. Says, whenever by an act or failure to perform a legal duty intentionally does any of the following, is guilty of maintaining a public nuisance, which is a misdemeanor, maintains or permits a condition which unreasonably annoys, injures, or endangers the safety, health, morals, comfort, or repose of any considerable number of members of the public, interferes with, obstructs, or renders dangerous for passage any public highway or right-of-way or waters used by the public, or is guilty of any act or omission declared by law to be a public nuisance for which no sentence is specifically provided. That is an exception in here for public nuisances. So, Mr. Chairman, I think the bill is fairly limited. I think it is consistent with what originally was intended by the 1982 law, and really rearranges some things in such a way that it meets some of the objections that some of the recent court cases have had relative to the construction of the law. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for any questions or thoughts. With me as well as Mr. Clevin, who represents, I believe, the Minnesota Turkey Growers and the Cattlemen's Association on this, and also is supportive of the bill.
Thank you. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we proceed any further, I like to pride myself in reading these bills closely. I have a technical amendment, an oral amendment, page 2, line 20. I believe that 3 should be a 2, not a 3.
Okay, we have that without objection. We'll incorporate that.
Ms. McKnight, did I read that correctly?
Line 16 should be a 2.
I think that's a 1.
Oh,
it goes back to the 1 line 16.
Okay, let's deal with line 20 first. Ms. McKnight, is a change from 3 to 2 a technical change that conforms with the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I think 3 is correct. I think the 2 belongs on line 16.
Okay.
Oh, no, I guess I'm wrong. I guess you are correct.
Ms. McKnight.
The other language is stricken.
Mr. Chair, members, I think Representative Coles is correct. If you look at it, the way it's been rewritten, because of the language it's struck from lines 6 to 15, the first clause is going to be number 1, to an animal feedlot facility, et cetera, or, and then on line 20, what is called 3 actually ought to be 2.
Okay.
I'd move to amend that, Mr. Chair.
Without objection, it's incorporated. Any other questions for the witness? Chair, recognize Mr. Clavin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, as Jerry mentioned, I'm Bruce Clavin. I represent Minnesota Turkey Growers, Cattlemen's Association, Broiler and Egg. I also represent some non-livestock groups, for example, the wheat growers and all the sugar beet growers. They also would be concerned about potential nuisance claims. For example, in farming, you're inherently going to have some dust and some noise and some odor associated with the operation. You're going to have dust when you're combining wheat. Doesn't matter what size you are. Same with sugar beet growers. They harvest all of their crop in a matter of 2 to 3 weeks in October, and they run 24 hours a day. There's noise going through the area. There's lights and so on, and we would want to be protected from nuisance claims for odor, dust, and noise beyond a livestock capacity. I know a lot of the focus is on that, but there are other folks in agriculture interested in this bill as well. As Jerry mentioned, it's a reasonable effort to try to address the court decision. We're not trying to go much beyond that. It's just some clarity is what the purpose of the bill is. So, Mr. Chairman, we throw a lot of agriculture group support behind the effort. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Seeing none, is there anyone with us today who wishes to speak in favor of House File 2658? Seeing none, the chair will recognize Karna Peters. Is Ms. Peters with us today? Guess not. How about Mr. Sobosieski? Well, I'm sure I butchered that one. Did I pronounce it correctly?
Mr. Chairman, well, thank you. My name is Paul Sobosieski.
Sobosieski.
Just got to say it a little bit slower.
Okay. Thank you. But I identified yourself for the record. If you'd proceed with your testimony, please.
Sure. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to testify here this afternoon on behalf of the Land Stewardship Project. The Land Stewardship Project is a farm and rural organization that works to promote sustainable agriculture. And by that, we mean first supporting the farmer and then the community and the environment. We believe that agriculture can be done in a way that's compatible with the environment and with the community. As a farmer, if you are a good actor, this bill is unnecessary. Some key concerns that I have with this bill, as amended, are is when you look at down at the bottom of the bill, on the first page under the amendment, the piece that lines 18 and 19. Number three, operates according to generally accepted agricultural practices. More or less, it puts up a defense as everybody does it defense. And I don't think that makes good policy. Another piece that I'm particularly troubled about is the removal of the section on the second page of the amendment that talks in lines 10 to 11. When an agriculture operation causes injury or direct threat or injury to the health and safety of a person. My sense is that the net result of this bill is a taking of neighbors' property rights who live next to a party causing a damage. Therefore, we oppose the bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Seeing no questions, thank you, Mr. Sobosieski. Representative
Mr.
Swenson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, could I just respond?
Certainly.
You know, he to his testimony, I don't think, you know, he talked about not needing the bill. There's been instances around the state where I think there has been a need for the bill. People have complied with all the rules, regulations, pollution control regulations and all this, and they have still been subject to you know, to lawsuits and so forth. So I think there is need for the bill.
Is there anybody else here today who wishes to speak in opposition to House File 2658 as amended?
Mr. Chair, I have a question on the House
file. Oh, certainly, ma'am, if you'd to take a seat and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Karen Olson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Attorney General's Office. And the Attorney General's office is testifying against this bill because the Attorney General's office believes that it's important to leave the right for these citizens to sue if there is a nuisance. The case that Mr. Schoenfield had mentioned was the Wendinger versus Forest Farms case, which appears to be the reason that this bill is being revised. The Attorney General's office did submit an amicus brief in that case. Nuisance suits are not easily proved suits. There's been some discussion today about the fact that government regulations should protect neighboring people from nuisances, but as the Wendiger case stated, really government regulations are a minimum. And what the Attorney General's office would recommend is that these people be allowed to bring a nuisance suit if they feel that the government regulations have not rectified a problem that they believe exists that is, you know, damage to their health or welfare. In addition, I've looked at several of the cases around the country, and a number of the suits have actually been brought by people who were longstanding farmers on the property. So it's not necessarily a case of people moving in and then claiming that there's a nuisance that existed. Also, I want to state for the record that I'm not commenting on the language as it sits today because the Attorney General's office, if whatever bill is approved, would obviously defend the constitutionality of it. I do, however, think it's important to bring to the committee's attention that an issue of constitutionality has been raised as the as respects the existing language of the case. It was raised just recently in Federal District Court, and I think it was Overgaard Farms versus Rock County Board of Commissioner. And what they were questioning is really a decision that came out of the Iowa court and the Borman case. And Iowa, the court decided that Iowa's Right to Farm Act was an unconstitutional taking of private property without just compensation. The Iowa Right to Farm Act essentially provided immunity from a nuisance suit for farm operation that was located in an agricultural area. And the court found that that nuisance immunity provision in Iowa law created an easement in the property affected by the nuisance, and that the state could not regulate so as to insulate the users from potential private nuisance claims without paying them just compensation. In the federal district court that Judge Frank decided, Judge Frank distinguished the Borman case from the existing Minnesota law on the basis that the existing law did not provide an absolute immunity. The existing law actually provided that if the nuisance was a nuisance at the inception, then it could be brought as a nuisance claim.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Representative Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Assistant Attorney General Olson, is it your view that the DE-1 amendment, as amended, creates an immunity from nuisance claims such that it would run afoul of the rule in Borman?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as I mentioned, the state is not testifying as to the constitutionality of this particular language because the state would obviously be in a position to defend the constitutionality. Really, all I wanted to raise for the committee was the reference to the Borman case because I believe that should a bill pass, that it likely will be challenged on the basis of constitutionality, similarly as it has been in Judge Frank's decision last summer.
Representative Lippman.
Just by way of comment, I support House File 2658. I think that it doesn't run afoul of the rule in Borman. It doesn't create an easement or immunity, an easement of adjoining properties or immunity of the farmer towards those claims. It does, as we have done for nearly 150 years, which is make substantive laws relating to agriculture by defining what words mean. And we've done that. It's not any different than literally 150 years worth of statutory work of this legislature, and I don't think raises either a constitutional concern or any policy concern. It's a good bill. We should pass it.
Thank you, Representative Lippman. Representative Adkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while I respect Representative Lippman's point of view, I'd ask and I won't put the Assistant Attorney General in that pickle of being asked that question, but I would be interested in hearing from the proponents how they believe that this differs from the blanket immunity that was thrown out by the Iowa court in the Borman case.
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm honored by the fact that I'm getting treated as a lawyer, which I'm not. But I would tell you this, that I did do some checking earlier today through our National Association relative to the nuisance laws around the country. And although it is true that Iowa did have Supreme Court overturn their nuisance law, it's my understanding that not only overturned the ag nuisance law, but all nuisance law. So that it was, and that the ag nuisance section is on appeal. Now, I don't want to stand here. I would never try to give misinformation to someone, but that's what I was told by the National Pork Producers Association today. So that I understand that
that that was the case. Now, to be honest with you, I don't quite understand that, because the ag nuisance section, if it was done by the Supreme Court, shouldn't have been, but that's what I was told. So I'm not certain if there were two different lawsuits relative to that or not. So I can't totally clarify. I'm only relating what I was told by the National Association, who keeps track. The other thing they told me was that Iowa was the only state that now does not have a nuisance law, that 49 states have protections under ag nuisance for farmers. And again, I'm relating something I was told on a phone conversation, because I thought I might be asked that question. But I can't stand here as a lawyer with a legal opinion on it.
Representative Atkins.
Follow up, and then an unrelated topic. My impression is that Dance is very, very close to the line. It comes to the point of nearly being, if not being, an absolute immunity, which would put it in jeopardy. And I'd rather not pass something out of this committee that we instantly know is going to be constitutionally challenged. That's more of an observation. My question is on the oral amendment to the DE-1. This is for Representative Swenson. On line 8, where you added the or contiguous counties, do we actually mean and contiguous counties? Because arguably what the language says to us is an or, is that we can look at any contiguous county that we want to and apply their best practice. I think what you mean is and. But it's your...
Mr. Chair, that may be have been an inadvertent mistake on my part. I think you're probably right that and would be there. Let me explain the reason for adding the contiguous counties. After we put this together, it became aware to myself and others that became aware of the fact that this does cover all agricultural operations, and there are certain kinds of things like potato growing, for instance, or some types of truck farms and things like that, that may only have one or two operations like that within a specific county. And since it covered everyone, what we were trying to accommodate was a larger geographic area, so that in the region that they would be. So I would suggest that and probably is more appropriate, but it wasn't intended to separate the two. It was just to try to get a larger geographic area than a specific county, so that there were more farms to compare it to.
Representative Atkins, do you care to offer an oral amendment?
I wanted to check with Ms. McKnight. In view of the testimony that we've heard and their intent, do you agree as well that it would be better off if it was and rather than or?
Ms. McKnight.
In order to capture a greater geographic area.
Representative Atkins, you remember there's this rule of statutory construction in Chapter 645 that and can include or, but from the discussion here it sounds like and is closer to what you mean, and so it might be a good change. It probably would work the way it is, but it's probably closer if you change it to and.
Okay. Right,
thank you, Representative Atkins. Ms. McKnight, just for clarification, if you then read the language as amended.
Members, now the oral amendment that was, let me back up and say that on page 1, line 8, after the word county, there was an oral amendment to insert or contiguous counties. The proposal now is to change that so that page 1, line 8, after county, there would be an amendment and contiguous counties.
Without objection, the amendment is incorporated to the bill. Any other questions for the witnesses or committee discussion with respect to this bill? Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, I wonder if that Iowa judge had ever been a farmer.
Any of the three of you have any knowledge as to the vocation of the justice?
Mr. Chair, I am not at all understanding of the judge's ancestry or anything about him, but I would tell you this, just as a kind of a sidelight to this. After the law was struck down, this is something, nuisance lawsuits are not brought in great numbers generally, but after the Iowa law was struck down, since that time, which I think was about a year and a half to 2 years ago, there's been 15 suits that have been brought forward. So that oftentimes the question gets asked, how many suits are like this? And the answer is there's not a large number, although a few have been mentioned today within Minnesota. But without the presence of the law, many more would be there.
Okay. Is there any final discussion with respect to this bill? Representative Biernan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Swenson, you said that all these practices that are commonly used are all consistent with state and federal law. They comply with all the various requirements that we impose upon farmers. Is that correct?
Representative Swenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Biernan. Yes. To be immune, the farmer would have to be complying with all our state and federal and county regulations and zoning and those types of things. If they were out of compliance on any of those things, that would, you know, that would take away their immunity.
Representative Biernat.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Swenson, it doesn't really seem to say that that way, though. I mean, it just says common practice. What if all the common practices are really inconsistent with state and federal law? What if all the farmers decide in a certain area to practice in a certain way? So I guess I would be more comfortable if you would state that in the bill that those practices that are consistent with state and federal law and are commonly used.
Representative Swenson.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Biernat. I think if you look above there, line 15 to 17 lists states that they have to be in compliance with all these things, and at the end of line 17 it says and operate as according. Yeah.
Representative Lippman, to that point?
Well, that was my point, which is it's cumulative, which is the zoning, the compliance with all the existing laws, and alongside standards, and the and is important. It's not one of the three, it's all three together.
Any further discussion of the bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2658 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion prevails, the recommendation is adopted. Representative Swenson, are you prepared to discuss House File 2442?
I understand the people that were going to help me present this bill are presenting the same bill in the Senate, and I was just informed that they're just about finished and we'll be back in a few minutes. So would you want to take another bill first?
Why don't we do that, Representative Swenson? We'll see if Representative Strand is here. I saw him earlier to present. There he is. Representative Strand, are you prepared to present House File 2104?
Move so, Mr. Chair.
Chair recognizes Representative Strand. Representative Strand, the chair will move House File 2104 that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe the bill text itself is not in your possession. So if you would like, I can either present the information as that gets obtained, or we can wait. Okay.
So it's a matter that the package just does not include House File 2104. Is that right, Ms. Fisher? Okay. Representative Strand, why don't you go ahead and proceed with your testimony while we're waiting for copies of the bill text.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think most of you are familiar with the Predatory Offender Registration Law, sometimes called the Sex Offender Registration Law, where they're required to be classified and register with authorities. And there is a loophole, or there has been a loophole in that law for some time that has really was brought to the forefront by in a court case called State v. Iverson, in which prosecution was overturned for an offender who was homeless or did not have a permanent address who was charged with violating the registration laws. And the court basically said, well, it specifically does not say in state statute that you need to have an address, and this person did not fail to comply according to the law. So this fills that loophole, basically places the onus upon the offender to register with local authorities, even if they do not have a permanent address. It talks a little bit in the law about, or in the bill, excuse me, about if a person lives out of a vehicle, if a person lives in the woods. If they don't have an actual numerical address, they simply have to provide as specifically as they can where they are, and provides for also some cleaning up of some old language in terms of definitions and terms in the law. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Are there any questions for the author? Representative Strand, do you have any witnesses to testify on behalf of the bill?
I do not, Mr. Chair. This did go through judiciary, and I had the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension at that time, but in this committee, I felt that I would take those myself.
Is there anybody with us today who wishes to speak in favor of House File 2104? Is there anyone who wishes to speak in opposition to House File 2104? Members, as mentioned, apparently either we don't have it or there's a wrong text with respect to House File 2104.
Wrong text.
It has the wrong text. The chair is open to suggestions. Would you like to have the bill laid on the table for the time being until there's an opportunity to review the text, or are you prepared to vote? Okay. I'm seeing it appears the consensus, Representative Strand, is that members certainly would like a chance to review the text. So I'm going to lay the bill on the table at this time, and then we'll pick it up once members have had an opportunity to review the text.
I'll wait in the room then. We're just going to lay it over for 3 minutes, right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. Representative Swenson, are you still waiting for your folks as well?
Yes.
Okay. Here's what we're going to do then. There are two bills that we want to wrap up, Representative Swenson, your House File 2442 and House File 2104. So, members, what I'm going to do, I'm just going to put the committee in recess for about 5 minutes here, and then subject to the call of the chair, we'll reconvene and take up Representative Strand's bill and then Representative Swenson's bill.
Representative Swenson, your bill was laid on the table. At this point, we'd like to call House File 4224.
No, my bill wasn't. I don't think this one was never brought up. The one that was laid on the table, I think, was Representative Strand's, I believe.
Which one would you like us to address, Representative Swenson?
Well, I have House File 2442, and I would like to move House File 2442. Be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance.
All right, go ahead, Representative Swenson.
House File 2442 makes changes to current Minnesota law that established a central notification system for farm product liens in the Secretary of State's office. The central notification system we use today was set up over a decade ago. It has worked well ever since for lenders, producers, and farm product buyers. It provides farm lenders with an easy and convenient way of letting buyers know when there's a lien on farm products. It is also a convenient way for buyers of farm products to tell when they need to write a check to both the seller and the lender. This bill makes the current CNS law consistent with amendments we made to the Universal Farm Commercial Code and related farm product lien statutes over the past 3 years. It also conforms our law to changes made at the federal level in 2002. In 2000, the legislature updated Article 9 of the UCC. In 2001, we recodified many old laws relating to farm product liens to make them consistent and easier to understand and use. In 2002, the Congress made changes to the federal laws governing the CNS so states could allow the use of computers and the Internet for filing documents with the Secretary of State's office. A task force of farm lenders, farm product buyers, farm organizations, and the State Bar Association have been working on this bill and the earlier changes for nearly 5 years. When the CNS system was first proposed, it met with a good deal of controversy. However, since the system got up and running, users have come to appreciate its value. So when this bill was developed, all the users came to the table to work on the changes. They included legal practitioners from the farm law section of the bar, a professor from Hamline University who teaches the UCC, lenders from the Minnesota Bankers Association, the Independent Community Bankers, and Farm Credit Services, buyers from the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association, farm organizations including the Minnesota Farm Bureau, Farmers Legal Action Group, Soybean Growers, Pork Producers, and Crop Retailers Association, the County Recorders Association, and the Secretary of State's Office. What we are doing here is updating and improving an already effective notification system used by lenders and farm product buyers across the state. Witnesses with me to provide further testimony are two of the people who worked on the bill over the years. I think if you have this piece, it says Philip Kunkel, but he is at the present time over in the Senate presenting the same bill. So we have John Appitz here, who has worked on this also, and also Burke Black from the Secretary of State's office. So I would ask Mr. Appitz for comments.
Representative Swenson, you're in good company. I believe both those gentlemen can explain the bill well. Chair recognizes Mr. Appitz. If you'd state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, please.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. My name is John Appitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer, and I represent Farm Credit Services, one of the organizations that was involved in crafting this legislation. And if I might very briefly, Mr. Chair, this is one of those sort of bills that needs to come before the House. It's in the Senate, and the legislature needs to be gotten done. We need to update our commercial code fairly, not fairly often, but on occasion. To be candid with you, it's terribly boring, but at the same time, it's something we got to get done. This is kind of, if I may, Mr. Chairman, the third leg of a three-legged stool. We made some changes to the Uniform Commercial Code Article 9 about 3 years ago, which deals with secured transactions, those transactions between lenders and borrowers. A couple of years, or a year after that, we made some changes to the laws governing agricultural liens. We had liens spread all over the statute books, some known, many unknown, and with Bert's help, Secretary of State's help, and a group of people who worked together, the same task force, we cleaned those up and made them much more functional and effective. This bill simply deals with the means by which lenders inform buyers of farm products that there is a lien on those farm products. The purpose for that is to make it much simpler for the buyer of the farm products to know that that lien exists and to put the proper parties, secured parties, on the check for payment when it's made. We had quite a battle over this about 12 years ago, but since that time, as our author has said, everybody has used it, really kind of enjoyed it, thought it worked very well, thought it was very cost effective, and now we have the opportunity of making it even more so because we can use technology, computer technology, authorized by the federal government to be able to implement this system. So that's essentially what it does. I'd offer to go through it section by section, but I think that discussion might be sufficient. With me is Bert Black, if I may, who's with the Secretary of State's office in their business division.
Okay. And Mr. Black, if we, just a moment, are there any questions for Mr. Appitz? Seeing none, the chair will recognize Mr. Black. If you'd state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bert Black, business and legal analyst with the Secretary of State's office. And I just want to reconfirm everything that Representative Swenson and Mr. Appitz have said. One of the things that I'd like to highlight is and we get about 10,000 filings under this system every year. The filings, it's not, some of you may be familiar with the Uniform Commercial Code. This is a little different from the Uniform Commercial Code in the sense that it's not a priority lien. Mainly this is to give notice to the farm product buyers on how to write the check. The notion being that once the check is written with both the bank and the farmer on the check, then if there are disputes, that will be settled privately. The reason for sort of the proximate cause, if you will, of doing this revision is the federal changes. The federal changes removed the requirement of an actual signature and do enable electronic filings, and it is our anticipation that we at Secretary of State's office will be within the next biennium turning this system into an online system, which of course is much faster for everybody involved, and speed is something that is necessary in securing these products and making sure that the checks are written properly. So I will confirm that the operation of this system has been highly boring, which is a good thing. And I'll take your questions if you have any.
Any questions for Mr. Black? Seeing none, is there any further committee discussion of House File 2442? Seeing none, Representative Swenson will renew his motion that House File 2442 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion prevails. The recommendation is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Strand, the chair will pick up House File 2104 from the table. Any questions? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2104 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion prevails. The recommendation is adopted.
Mr. Chair, if I might make a comment, you really made my first opportunity of having my seat made in my committee really not very much fun. So
if you wish to hate Representative Strand, we can hold him here.
No, we're going to send him along. I think we see him again on Friday.
I'll be under the desk here, Mr. Chair.
with the Lions and Tigers, Bill?
That one? Okay.
Is there any further business to come before the Civil Law Committee today? Seeing none, the committee stands adjourned.